Hello, hello, and welcome to the 32nd, I believe, Metroplexity podcast. This is Kinnack, also known as Landon Winkler, coming back to you from sunny Columbus, Ohio. Not ironically sunny this time, it's actually beautiful out. So in addition to reaching a nice, you know, power of two for our number of podcasts, this also is our fifth anniversary podcast, anniversary of the game, I guess, not of the podcasts. I have no idea when those started. But, yeah, so 5 years. It's pretty impressive, really. I, going in, figured probably would be done by now, but also haven't really been able to put my full focus on the game for most of those years, so, and have had, you know, the usual assortment of life-related issues. So, 5 years. We'll probably get to talk a little bit more about that going forward, and we've got a bunch of questions about various other stuff. I also just got back from Gen Con, and I cheated a little bit and read the first question. The first question's about that, so I'll go ahead and just jump straight into the questions. First off, we have Cryptodynamic. Been a while since I've managed to get some questions together for a podcast thread. Congrats on 5 years of Metroplexity. Thanks very much. Looking forward to five more, more than five more, as the case may be. How was GenCon? See any upcoming stuff that looked interesting? Might as well get this one out of the way first. Well, let's see. I do actually have a giant pile of books next to my desk, which covers, I guess, probably most of what I thought was super interesting. We've got the first issue of Wrath of the Righteous. I'm a big Pathfinder fan, so I have a subscription to their Adventure Pathline. They actually let you pick all of the stuff up, all of your subscription stuff up at Gen Con this year, which was kind of cool. It was the experience of going and, like, buying things without being so straining on the budget. Just kind of nice. I like picking things up at Gen Con and, you know, going back to the room and doing some reading and so forth. That's sort of a big part of the experience to me. So being able to do that without, you know, buying a bunch of stuff on top of the stuff that I'm subscribed to. It was pretty nice. Big thing for folks here with Metroplexity, probably the new edition of Shadowrun 5th, which is, I have not actually gotten a chance to read over yet, but is supposed to be doing pretty good. What I have heard, don't quote me on this, because like I said, I haven't read it, but what I've heard is that it is actually able to handle hacking, like, in real time, with other, not, obviously, like, in the same scale of time as, like, combat, which has been a problem with basically every previous edition of Shadowrun. But yeah, between it actually being wireless and the, like, addition of drones and personal area networks and stuff, has actually, hopefully, assuming the rules pan out, has made hacking a, like, viable part of the game, rather than being completely separate from everything else, which is kind of ironically an issue we faced as well. And are hopefully staring down with all the courage of, you know, a 30-odd-year-old game designer. Let's see, I picked up Numenera, which is Monty Cook's new game. He had a big Kickstarter for it, but I was not entirely sold by the previews they had before the Kickstarter, so I just waited, got a little more information, picked up the book when it came up. I do sort of heart Monty, so, I mean, he's many, many years ago, when I started going to Gen Con, Monty was sort of the guy I want to be when I grow up. So, I don't have a very objective opinion. I actually haven't gotten to read much of Numenera yet. So, and by much of, I mean it's actually still in its its wrappings. Hopefully it's awesome. It doesn't seem to be quite as... the original previews, the reason that I didn't kickstart it or pick it up through that means is the original preview made it look super jargony. They had sort of like an intro short story that was basically just a wall of jargon. And I figured out later that they were just like introducing all of the jargon in like a short story. It still probably would have been a little more pleasant spaced out. But like that's all the jargon in the entire game, so that makes it way less offensive. Like if it had all been, you know, like sentences where like three of the words are new words, I probably would have just skipped it, even though I heart Monty. But they seem to, not surprisingly, know what he's doing. So have Mythic Adventures for Pathfinder. Looks pretty cool. It's an interesting design, sort of the epic rules for Pathfinder. It does not... for anyone who's familiar with 3rd edition or 3.5 D&D or Pathfinder, epic rules allowed you to go above 20th level. They were the 21st to 30th level rules. Problem being that the math is already basically shot by about 18th level, and just gets worse as you go. Maybe even before 18th, maybe even like 15th, but it just gets increasingly bad. So, I mean, there are some arguments like where the line in the sand of this is totally fucked is, but 30th was definitely well past it. So they actually have a just totally separate set of rules that are mythic rules, as you could probably guess from the name of the supplement, that let you more just do badass stuff integrated throughout the length of the game, which is pretty cool. And also, by the end, if you're like, you know, 20th level and 10th mythic tier, I believe it is, it's either tier or rank, pretty sure it's mythic tier, you can do shit like take on demon lords and stuff like that, which plays heavily into their new Wrath of the Righteous adventure path. It was sort of an interesting experience. I read through it and was like, wow, a lot of this is really complicated, which is unfortunate because Pathfinder is pretty complicated, and I wouldn't want to add more complexity to the game. And I was like, well, that's a little disappointing. And then I was going onto their site to do a review and, like, poked through it again, and I realized that there's actually a really cool thing going on where there is a lot of really complicated stuff, but it all sort of rides on other complicated stuff. So, like, if you're already a complicated character, there are, like, mythic feats and mythic tier abilities and stuff that are complicated, like, not particularly more complicated than the other stuff you're doing, but at the same time, if you're a simple character, the feats and path abilities that you're probably going to be using are actually quite simple. Some of them are pretty elegant. And I mean, like, you could certainly, you know, jump back and forth, and if you're playing a spellcaster, that's just going to be complicated because that's the nature of the beast, that sort of thing. But it really rides on the existing strength of having not complicated characters and sort of more complicated characters. Or rather, like, not having all characters be the same level of complexity, which I like a lot. And a lot of pretty baller art. It's sort of the... they have illustrations, obviously, of all of their iconic characters, you know, after they've, you know, ascended to mythic status. And a lot of them are sort of like, you know, it's what you'd expect, you know, sort of like bonus, like, energy crackles or, like, weirdness. But, like, also just a lot of shirtless dudes, which I appreciate in that... I feel like Pathfinder actually does a really good job with this in general. They aren't afraid of putting a little bit of cheesecake in there. I mean, there are definitely female characters who are showing off a little skin and are quite attractive. But they include every bit as many attractive dudes showing off skin, which I appreciate a lot. And they also obviously include both male and female characters who are dressed appropriately. And in general, the ones showing off, both males and females, are the ones who that's sort of appropriate for their character concept. Like the sorcerer and the monk are, you know, kind of underdressed, which is not, you know, the most terrifying, not the most, like, out-of-character thing. It's not like the fighter's running around in a plate mail bikini or anything. But yeah. Anyway, oh yeah, there's a lot of dudes whose, you know, shirts have obviously exploded. And actually, like, no real, like, mythic cheesecake, which, whatever, it's fine by me. The normal over-representation of scantily clad women is, I'm okay with that, just balancing itself out sometime. Speaking of the art, we've got Visions of War, which is Wayne Reynolds. This is more for Liz than for me. I was like, hey, there's a Wayne Reynolds art book coming out. She's like, get it. So, it has been gotten. That's pretty good, because, you know, Wayne Reynolds. Lots of, you know, character sketches and stuff. He does most of his work in acrylic? I think all of his work. Pretty sure it's acrylic. But, yeah. But a lot of the preliminary sketches side by side with the final stuff. So it'll just be a nice thing to set out for our friends, all of whom are geeky, but not all of whom, you know, play Pathfinder. Let's see. We've got Dungeon World, which I tend to pick up a couple of random books that sound interesting that got Ennies every year at Gen Con. So, I guess, if you're a, you know, third-party publisher, you should know that at least some people buy stuff because you win awards. But if you're a third-party publisher, you probably already knew that, or at least suspected it deep in your heart. Dungeon World, I feel, is sort of an interesting beast. I'm actually going to take a tangent before I jump into Dungeon World. They also released 13th Age. Reaction was apparently quite good. I did not grab a copy of it, so I can't speak to it directly. It seems like it's being pitched very heavily as a replacement for 4th edition D&D, because that's going away. And unlike 3rd edition, they didn't leave a license lying out there for someone like Paizo to pick up and run with it and make them look, you know, kind of silly. But Dungeon World is very much a... It's sort of like D&D as viewed through the lens of a, like, more modern indie RPG. I feel like most indie RPGs are set in, like, the real world or variants of the real world. And most fantasy games sort of follow in the footsteps of D&D to various degrees. And this one very much, like, thematically follows D&D, but rules-wise is totally off in a different direction. I'm not sure as far as, like, gameplay, how much I like it. It seems a little not what my group would go for. This is going to sound, well, I guess it might not be terribly surprising since you're all sort of, you know, playing my game, but my group tends towards a very GM controlled sort of line of play, and I don't mean like railroading or anything, but like they're big fans of leaving the setting sort of in my hands, and presenting the challenges to them and running through that, whereas most modern sort of indie games share out that responsibility a lot more, including Dungeon World, so I would be very surprised if we ever ended up playing that, although if you're looking for a indie game that sort of hits on the themes of D&D, it's a good choice. I've heard 13th Age also is sort of similar to that, but don't quote me on that. Let's see, we've got Pathfinder Goblins, which is their new part of their comic line. They have a set of comics sort of following the adventures of the iconic characters, and they also have started a mini-series of comics that are literally just about goblins. Might end up with Goblin Overkill by the third or fourth one, but it's fairly enjoyable now. I would probably not suggest it for someone who doesn't, you know, heart Pathfinder goblins, because that's all you're getting. Also grabbed The Kobold Guide to World Building, which looks exciting, but I haven't gotten a chance to read yet. It's just a collection of a bunch of articles about building fantasy worlds by a bunch of, you know, really awesome authors. I mean, Wolfgang Bauer, because he's Kobold. I mean, he basically is Kobold Publishing. Slash Open Design. But, like, Zeb Cook, Monty Cook, Jeff Grubb, Chris Pramus, folks like that. Is it Pramus? I forget. And unlike the event that you were listening, I apologize if I mispronounced your name. So, yeah, there's that. That's sort of what I picked up. Like I said, 13th Age got a bunch of favorable press. There's a lot of good vibes around the Paizo folks, who we spent, I mean, most of our time not, like, you know, hanging out with, but, you know, sort of following them around, seeing what's up. They have a bunch of new products coming out, some of which sound pretty exciting, but mostly only if you're already a Pathfinder player. So if you are, I would suggest looking forward to their upcoming releases, but if you're not, I'd say, bang, give it a try, if that's up your alley. Certainly before you worry about the upcoming stuff. Other than that, big event of the con, True Dungeon, long my favorite part of Gen Con. On the years that VGL, Video Games Live, was there, had compete with VGL, but absent Video Games Live, it's just kind of, you know, wins. It's a little unfair. For those of you who haven't heard me rave about True Dungeon before, it's basically, it's actually in one of the main exhibit halls in the convention center now. And they take entire exhibit hall and basically set up, I mean, almost like stage sets or like haunted house type sets. Do like a series of dungeons running through the hall, and you just sort of, crawl through the dungeons. The combat is handled through sort of a shuffleboard, like bar shuffleboard, like hand, not with the actual, like, weird, like, broomy things. There, where you're trying to, like, land your sort of weapon puck on the outline of the monster to get hits, sort of with a layer of D20-esque rules over it, and then also puzzles, lots of puzzles. Some of which are fairly brutal, some of which are rather, just easy and fun. They actually had two complete separate dungeons this year, which was kind of neat, and each version of those, you can do combat or puzzle. And each one of those, you can do, I think it's normal, hard, or nightmare. You can just choose the beginning of the run, which you do. And a lot of people run through multiple dungeons. They'll do, I mean, it was Lycans, Afoot was one of them, and Golem Bane was the other. And, well, you know, running around in, like, you know, a haunted house with a bunch of werewolves is kind of the Metroplexity way, right? Running through a, you know, steampunk tower is hard to pass up. And they had a lot of fun with it. A lot of just very, you can justify some pretty crazy puzzles when you start talking about, you know, steampunk and wizardry and switches and insane gnomes and so forth. So they had a lot of fun with it. We had a lot of fun playing with it. We almost managed to get Rob Boulder from Earthworld and his crew to come along with us. They unfortunately were unable to make it at the last minute. The time slot we had was too close to the hall closing for them to make it. So, alas, but still had a lot of fun. And it's sort of it's interesting in something like World of Warcraft or things like that. God help you, like League of Legends, you just loathe pickup groups, right? Like, it's the worst thing to be forced into a pickup group. A special circle of hell. But in True Dungeon, the people who show up when you're, like, down some people, people will, like, sign up on, like, a paging list, basically, and, like, if you don't have enough people to fill your slots, they'll, you know, drop in. Most of those are people who actually do a lot of runs. So, very... we've never had any problems with randoms in True Dungeon. It's always been a really positive experience, which is, like, so diametrically opposed to, like, the usual, you know, pickup group experience. But, yeah, we ended up filling a couple of slots, and we brought... actually, basically, our entire gaming group was at Gen Con and went through. Unfortunately, we didn't know where Puyo was going to be living. Tangent. Puyo has been in our Pathfinder game. We're running through Rise of the Rune Lords. And they are at the start of Book 5 of 6 after, I guess, just under a year of gameplay. And, it's a little bit of a weird experience for me. Most of my campaigns end up looking a lot like Metroplexity, sort of mysteries, within conspiracies, within what the fucks. And running someone else's material. Admittedly, the person who designed it is very much like on the same wavelength with me on a lot of things, but running someone else's material has sort of tamped that down a bit. Which Liz, if no one else, really appreciates, because she's played in, you know, like, my last 6 or 7 campaigns, so it can be sort of overwhelming after, you know, I guess, God, like, 12 years or something of gaming. So, that's been nice. Puyo is playing a, dwarf rogue with a mofu beard, which is basically, like, squishy, almost. It's somehow very slightly different than Puyo Puyo, but I'm not exactly sure. Like, I feel like mofu is more like cotton balls and Puyo is more like rubber. But don't quote me on that. My Japanese is not that good. Yeah, we also have Durgan, who plays Metroplexity, and a friend of ours who works with Liz by the name of Jessica, who is inexplicably a sports fan. It's sort of confusing, but yeah. So, gaming's been good. Oh, but yeah, we just introduced Jessica to gaming, God, maybe 6 months ago. I mean, she had been like a gamer before, like, you know, video games, Magic the Gathering even, but hadn't done any role-playing. We were like, hey, we're running this game, and, you know, we're not, you know, total creepers. She was like, woo! And, yeah, just totally has gone completely nuts. It's kind of hilarious. But, yeah, she came to Gen Con with us, and Durgan came to Gen Con with us. Had a... Durgan, I'm not sure if he's capable of having a complete blast. He's sort of a... dour, snarky sort by nature, but Jessica was completely, you know, over the moon, and freaking loved True Dungeon, so that's good. Their tickets are more easily available now, because they're doing so many runs. They sort of, like, capped out at, like, the physical, they changed venues from one of the ballrooms to one of the convention hall showrooms, which is just freaking huge. I mean, they've got like the four dungeons, which is like, I mean, seven rooms and a bunch of, you know, hallways and connective tissue and so forth. Plus, you know, like the sign up area and like all of the guts behind it, and are able to get a lot of people through. They were talking to a very nice woman who co-runs it, and sort of the one who does all of the, there's a lot of the organizational stuff. And she said that there were five tickets open when the con started. Five spots that hadn't been, I mean, claimed. Which is, may not sound like much, but is infinitely more than has been open in any other year. We were not actually even able to get in last year. And this year, we actually had our pick of several slots for the whole team. So that was very cool. Let's see. I think that is my tale of Gen Con. I have successfully not gotten con crud so far, cross your fingers, which usually I come home from Gen Con and I'm just out for a week. So I actually, you know, got some work done instead, which was pretty cool. And yeah, my only real complaint is that they sort of double scheduled downtown with Gen Con and like motorcycle rally, which is just terrible. Like, I don't particularly care about motorcycles. I mean, drive whatever the hell you want. It's not a big deal. I mean, I would rather people drive motorcycles than, like, you know, Hummers or something, right? But motorcycles that are intentionally, like, louder than they need to be, I don't really find very agreeable. And by don't find very agreeable, I mean, I think it should probably be legal to just throw rocks at them, because they are intentionally hurting people, and it seems like it's only fair to intentionally hurt them back. I think that makes sense, but I'm pretty sure the Indianapolis police do not. So, aside from motorcycles trying to take over downtown and failing, because there are like 50,000 geeks there. Oh, that was the other thing that was actually super cool. Gen Con was just shy of 50,000 individual registrants. It was something like 140,000, like, turnstile, like, person days. But yeah, they had a fuck ton of people there, which was pretty cool. And extremely well-run show, particularly for having that many people there. Like, very little congestion, anything like that. I mean, there was, like, a snarl in the exhibit hall one time because some company was holding, like, a raffle at their booth, and people just were standing around, and it caused some congestion. But no, just, like, straight-up traffic problems at all, even within the exhibit hall. So, that was very cool. I guess the other thing that's noteworthy about Gen Con, and this is deep on the industry insider track, but I think is fairly interesting. I obviously come from a, you know, D&D sort of centric background, so I have my roots deep in, like, OD&D, just to say, Rule Cyclopedia, in my case, D&D. Which some people would argue is not OD&D, it's something else, but whatever. But, like, yeah, Redbox, Rule Cyclopedia, and Second Edition. So, roots deep in, you know, TSR, and very much in Third Edition. As I mentioned, sort of wanted to be Monty Cook when I grew up. making that statement, you know, when I was, I guess I wasn't quite 20 yet. Maybe I was. Around 20. I still don't feel particularly grown up, but you'll have that. But yeah, and then sort of wandered off with the faction of people that I actually, you know, that were doing work that I liked. They were producing more of the kind of game that I wanted to play, which is Paizo, Hoodoo Pathfinder, rather than Wizards of the Coast, who did a 4th edition. But anyway, like those are sort of the for a long time TSR, and then Wizards of the Coast was like the people who like had like it would be like going up against, you know, Microsoft in a, you know, word processing software thing. Like, you're just not, that's just not happening. It's not, the product may be good, it may be bad, it doesn't even matter. It's what everyone is using. And so, with that in mind, and so, Paizo has sort of moved up into that slot, or to share that slot, depending on who you're talking to. Basically, if you think that 4E is the best thing ever, you think that they're sharing. If you look at industry statistics, you think that Paizo's is winning. At least, okay, I'm going way too deep down the rabbit hole, but basically the Wizards had launched as almost like subscription model with 4th edition that had cut them off from a lot of support at the local level, since it's like a website, a subscription website, effectively, that more or less makes it easier to just have the subscription than to buy their books. So they're actually making probably more money through the subscription than they would have through books, but at the local level, game stores don't make any money off the subscriptions, they make money off the books, and if people aren't buying the books, there isn't, I mean, basically, WotC has sort of cut off its Wizards of the Coast, so WotC, sort of cut off their nose to spite their face a little bit there. Anyway, that's neither here nor there. So, 4th edition sort of imploded, once Paizo, took over. I mean, the timing there is, so, Paizo took the lead in sales because, I mean, people weren't buying 4th edition books because there was no point to buy 4th edition books, and WotC didn't really even seem to want people to buy books. They wanted people to subscribe. They sort of, shortly after Pathfinder took over as, like, the market leader with actual book sales, WotC, sort of shut down 4th edition fairly publicly, and that was, so, the year before last, they had basically nothing at their booth. Like, they had a booth there, and they were showing stuff off. It was, they had no new product. Last year, they had started up a, I forget if it was right before or right after Gen Con, but around then, they started up a playtest for 5th edition, a public playtest. It might have been right after Gen Con, but they had a booth, but it was very, I mean, like, story-focused. Like, it was like, hey, look at, like, Drow are cool. You know, we've got the Forgotten Realms. You like the Realms, right? What have you. Which isn't, like, super weird for Wizards. They've never sold a lot at their booth. But anyway, this year they just did not have a booth in the exhibit hall. Which is noteworthy because there are a lot of people, myself included, who spend most of their time at the convention at the exhibit hall. You basically only end up doing things outside of the exhibit hall if you specifically, you know, look for them. Like if I had wanted to, you know, play some Pathfinder Society stuff, I could go up to, you know, the room where they're doing that and play some Pathfinder. Not what I do at cons, but, or what I actually do at cons, go to seminars. But you have to, like, be like, oh, I want to go to the seminar, you know, figure out where it is, go there. So there was a room, apparently, somewhere, where they were doing, like, 5th edition playtests slash showing off stuff. But nothing in the exhibit hall to, like, point people towards that, which was very strange. And, I mean, whether that was, you know, a good use of their money or not, I have no idea. his booths at Gen Con are pretty expensive. Admittedly, they're boxy. They have a ton of money, but they do still, you know, own Magic the Gathering, which is just like printing money, effectively, especially for Magic Online. But I had, like, no exposure to anything D&D related, like actual D&D as opposed to Pathfinder, at Gen Con, because even looking for stuff, there was very little that that was there to catch one's attention. So I thought that was very interesting. They'll probably have, like, you know, a big party next year for a 5th edition release, assuming they're releasing at Gen Con, which is basically what everyone's assuming. But, yeah, I thought that was very interesting. Yeah, the show was sort of actually being dominated by the offerings of people who used to work for Wizards of the Coast. A lot of the Paizo employees used to be Wizards folks, including their CEO, Lisa Stevens, who basically helped get the company off the ground. I want to say that she was... I feel like she wasn't one of their founding members, but she was one of the first. But she was the first employee, if that makes sense. She was the one that they sort of like hired to actually make the organization run. Runs Paizo now. Liz actually had a really cool conversation with her about being a woman in position of authority and like how that, you know, plays out in a work environment where people are like not, you know, douchebags or anything, but just like sort of the undercurrents there that can cause problems even when you have people who are, you know, understanding that, you know, gender roles are fucked. So Paizo and a bunch of her employees at Paizo also used to work for Wizards, but it was like her and, you know, Monty Cook, who also used to work for Wizards, putting out Numenera, and 13th Age, which I mentioned, is two of their ex-employees got together and put together a new game to sort of replace the game that Wizards has sort of let die. lots of people who used to work for them producing products that are extremely high quality and very interesting, and they just are not making themselves heard at all, despite very much having the money to do so, if they so desired. I thought that was very interesting, sort of a business perspective. More on the situation as it develops. Let's talk about something other than Gen Con. Does the writing on the Tome of Binding in my custom avatar mean anything? Looks like I might say 1921, and I'm curious where that came from. Let me take a look. I would hazard a guess that if it says anything, says something in Japanese, because Puyo. So it's either Puyo not writing, looking like writing, or it's something in Japanese. I would have to ask Puyo about that. So hopefully it doesn't say, like, you know, I love Yaoi or something. I'm guessing it doesn't. Probably. Might it be possible we can get some mellow cream pumpkins for Halloween? The king of Halloween candy, evil and or etheric versions are also acceptable. Seems only reasonable. This is the sound of me creating a note to work on Halloween stuff in. Because I'm going to need to get cracking on that. Yes, that seems entirely reasonable. Have you considered anything like Kingdom of the Lynx, Clan Dungeons, or Twilight Heroes, League Battlefields for Metroplexity games? I'm not sure what form it would take, but I'm curious if you've had any thoughts. You can see sort of the early version of those thoughts in the abandoned subway. Sort of a unlockable... The concept for that actually comes from I'm not going to remember the specific game here. There's sort of the lineage, pun, of Korean MMOs, and they are basically all PvP. I shouldn't say that. The ones that I am familiar with are all PvP. They might have hundreds of MMOs that are PvE only, I don't know. But one feature that I've seen in several of them is area control unlocking special dungeons, which is sort of where that came from, that the subway. And I really like that. Actually, there's a bunch of expansion I'd like to do on that at some point, but there's a lot of expansion I'd like to do on a lot of things. I would also not be surprised to see something more like semi-PVE stuff based on that sort of tied into the gang mechanics, like a battlefield against NPC gangs, stuff like that. Or, you know, Midgard or whomever. Or like a straight-up like war scenario. There's nothing like immediately in the works for that. The gangs are mostly intended as a vessel for a PvP. But I think that the mechanics are there and could be pretty cool to have a, alternate, some random cool group PvE stuff. Some questions, and by some I mean a ton of questions, from Magnifico. I've been trolling through old podcast charts to see how some of your cryptic hints panned out. A long time ago, you said there were 7 new skills in the second Charnel House / Black Book. We found 7, well, 8 if you count Fire Tamer, but one of those is Pyro, which wasn't new even when the quest rolled. Is there still an unfound skill in there somewhere? Yes. There is exactly one unfound skill in there somewhere. And there should still be one unfound one with the original, tied into the original goal quest. Probably not next to the other skills numerically, though, because of when it got added. But yeah. Is there at least one hideout enhancement that we are still missing? I don't believe so. I think the satellite dish is the one that went in last. Did we eventually notice the really subtle feedback that the red glass goggles were giving us on the road to finding Cracked Pearl, or did we just blunder onto the item? If we missed the feedback, any hint what it is was? I'm pretty sure that you didn't. I think you just sort of brute forced that one. Let me double check the wiki page here. Yeah, no. I would, my hint would probably be, get halfway to getting the Kraken's Pearl and see what's different. That's kind of a jerk hint, but there we go. You might just have to, figure that one out in reverse. A while ago you gave a cryptic hint manually. Was that a hint to use the paper mache manually with Glittering Artistry and Nightmare Artistry active, as opposed to using a known recipe and missing out on making cool stuff, even though it was so close? Or was that a hint pointing at something else? No, I'm pretty sure that was a hint pointing at the artistry buffs and paper mache. Is there a day-to-day source to breathe the Emperor's Effect, or is the Rending Smoke technique only going to be learnable on Metroplex Day? No. Let's see. Yes, that's an or, so just no. So no or no is no. I guess I'll just leave it at that, because I'm a jerk. Halloween is coming up fast, and with our once yearly chance to find out what the tattooed man was handing out last time around, you said that we don't have all the painted items yet, and that we can get about halfway to what he was talking about before Halloween. Can you give us any nudges? Here are some things inquiring minds want to know. Is everything we need in the Hall of Paintings, or need to bring in moving parts from outside? Do we have to discover seemingly unrelated stuff before we can even make progress with this? I don't believe so. I think you're okay. Is it easy to talk yourself out of being able to find what you're looking for? No, that would be pretty challenging. The recommended donation guide is described as humming a strange melody that you feel like you should recognize. Stories at an exhibition mentions that patterns in the stars are music, that anyone can learn the song and anyone with a little skill can play it, but few do. Is that laying the groundwork for future stuff, or can we follow up on it now? Is there some way we can acquire a little skill with music? It is not unrelated, exactly, but it's, I don't believe it's a direct music trigger. But stuff that you're talking about there is not completely unrelated. There don't seem to be any versions of the Starry Sky or Sunset painting that appear while you are etheric. Is there some way to unlock those? There should be a version of the Sunset painting. If you lay out the etheric paintings and the non-etheric paintings, I think there's a version of the Sunset one, unless I screwed something up. Is as far as the there, I guess, unless I screwed something up, there is an etheric version of each of the paintings. It may not be immediately obvious which is which, though. Is there some way to see more details in the large landscape? I mean, other than crawling in there. And oh, I guess you mean the, yeah, other than crawling in there, you should be, how come my character doesn't explode the screams and other stuff mentioned in Forsaken Moor? It's not just Pete in there. Oh, yeah, someone asked if there could be fishing in there. Which I thought was kind of delightful. One of those things that should not work, but is hilarious enough that it probably should work. But not the understanding there is that there's nothing super exciting with these streams and forest and so forth. Last time around, you mentioned a cycle that we haven't figured out how to complete yet. Care to elaborate on that a bit? I think you already mentioned it, so I'm not going to be too worried about it. For your evil amusement, there are things I want to do in it, but can't figure out how. Use the blade and feather to tattoo myself, using black Peter's ink. Well, you are not far off, but, you'll just have to wait and see about that one. Give a painted flower to the painted woman. What can I say? I'm hopeless romantic. That would be kind of adorable. She's kind of a jerk, though. Like, in the etheric form, if you just, you know. I guess you could be a weird encounter. You can't really interact with them normally in the their non-etheric forms. Dump water from the sloshing vase on the phoenix. Concoct some paint thinner. Often when I'm working on one of your puzzles, some event, reward, or legacy on earthly items seems like it'd be part of a good solution, but I always figure that the solution to the puzzle depending on an item that some current players have no way to get other than the Omnimaw is a big no-no. How hard is it to resist the pull of working legacy items into a puzzle when they fit so well? There are a handful of times that I've hooked in older items. Mostly, I am able to resist I would rather have those items usually be, you know, something that's available in the wider game. Admittedly, some of the things that are available in the wider game are really pain in the ass to get, or like haven't been discovered or whatever. But I'm not gonna, you know, have an item, something require a specific gears, you know, Metroplex Day Rocket or something like that. Might have it require, like, an item that reappears every year, that seems less jerkish, or have there be an option of having a particular item, like if, you know, if there were, like, a scene in, you know, the winter mirrorscape that was like, oh god, you're so cold that your ears fall off. I mean, obviously, you know, the hat, the unearthly hat that I should really go and give a buff to, because it's actually in rotation right now, if I remember correctly, would totally have to work, right? Like, I would totally have to protect your ears from getting frostbite and falling off. Can anyone tell that I grew up in Wisconsin, by the way? Because I totally can. I guess you might have guessed Minnesota, too. Minnesota and Michigan, also acceptable answers. But cheese. But I would probably also, you know, allow, like, you know, a containment suit helmet, you know, to protect it, or a whole containment suit even, like something, some other way of doing it. But just having, like, a little text call out or not, I really appreciate doing. It's one of those things that I just enjoy way more than I probably should. It's sort of like, oh, I can do this, and, like, now that, yeah, there's some stuff in the new hacking stuff that's like, oh, I totally have to reference, like, 80 old items here, because this is so sweet. Not actually 80, like, you know, like 3 or 4 usually, but at least, like, calling those out. Question from XGive. Is it possible to get new VR masks? I think I've seen one from formatted site once, but I can't trust my memory on what I did this morning, much less something from a year or two ago. Viral masses. I want to say that those are still available, but don't quote me on that. I guess if they're still available, I would not expect them to still be available for long. So if they will probably, I'm not 100% sure, honestly, if they're available right now. I want to say that they are, but not 100%. But they will probably stop being, unless I give them some functionality within Novos, and have them show up there. What determines, some question from Bowles. Actually, give me a second. You have exactly one question. I will actually go and find the answer for you. This will take a second, because I actually have to dig around in the code. I know where it would be if it was there. Looks like probably not. Okay. I'm actually doing a search now. Seeing what comes up. It's not where I thought it would be, so it's probably just old code. Echo chamber. Okay. Yeah. If there is, I'm not immediately seeing it. There, it might be buried somewhere really weird. But if it has, I've outsmarted myself. So it does not look like it is currently available. questions from Bowles. What determines whether an effect is removed by Slag's antidote? Finding a common link between Fey Blessing, Call of the Gift, Spectral Curse, and Burning Vision that doesn't include various other effects is a little difficult. It has been a while since I've looked at the Slag's antidote. Let me see here. There are some. Yeah, it's just the categorization of the effects. So it's not just like an arbitrary list, but the way things are categorized may be, you know, a little arbitrary. Let me. Doesn't look totally arbitrary to me. So I think he might be okay. Is there a way to complete the Punk Uprising quest without giving the punks explosives? I don't feel like there is. Unless you meet their sponsor, at the very least you're not going to get skills out of it. Is there any hidden content connecting the various encounters in which you get attacked or thrown out by security guards? No, I'm pretty sure there isn't, but that would be kind of hilarious. Just picturing, like, you know, a t-shirt. Like, I got thrown out of every, you know, location in Metroplex, and all I got was this lousy t-shirt. Is there anything else we can talk to Watson Jr. about? There are quite a few different conversation topics that he has available. I would not be surprised if you found all of them. I don't think that any of them are super hard to unlock or related to content that you haven't discovered. I mean, there might be some, like, old Halloween text that didn't get recorded or something like that, but it should... I think that you've found everything. Pretty sure. Because I've gotten questions. Someone has found all of them. How about that? Because I know the only remotely obscure ones I've talked to people about before, so. Why does the Mad Surgeon's Kit first aid bonus apply to healing, helping other people in contradiction to the description? Oh no. Did I contradict the description? that shouldn't do that. I can remove that tag. I should also, this is unrelated, but I should at some point rework how first aid works. It really needs to be split up into a couple of different. Actually, it doesn't look like it should be able to, so go ahead and let me know where it's letting you help other people, and I will get that fixed. Could we ever get items that function as equipment or cyberware? Certain equipment like the rolling eyeball, or if we want to get really crazy, every heart offhand, seem potentially installable. I don't see any reason why not. I mean, I'd have to fidget with the code a tiny bit to make it work, but no, it's reasonable. Now that I've spent 700 credits to buy a teaching guide, which is severe annoyance, sufficient legal defense for murder. No, unfortunately, the same issues I was talking about with motorcyclists and. To clarify, for anyone out there who rides a motorcycle that isn't super fucking annoying, I don't mean you. I mean the people who roar around on their unnecessarily expensive Harley equivalent motorcycles. I actually meant Hummer equivalent, but there was a Freudian slip there. But no, severe annoyance is not a sufficient legal defense for murder. If it was, you wouldn't have so many problems with David on the quad. How much Metroplex do you hope is under the influence of power code? Surprisingly large amount of the early stuff is less going forward. Liz has largely trained me out of the up too late, tripping balls on caffeine sort of approach. I don't mean that euphemistically, actually. I literally mean, like, there's something magical about the state of way too little sleep and way too much caffeine, where, like, you are just way more useless than, like, even a lot of, like, straight up, you know, illegal drugs. And write really fucked up code. But in the sense that it may not do what you mean it to at all. And in the sense that, like, there's just some pretty warped shit there. And some questions from Al. We have a lot of questions this time, so if you need to, like, pause this and, like, hit the bathroom or something, I will totally not judge you. Or, you know, no, because I'm just a recording. Oops, I accidentally scrolled all the way back up to Magnificos while I was looking at the Magnifico. that just makes me giggle. Happy 5 years. This is Al, as I said, I'm sorry. Happy 5 years. Any reflections on the last five and next five? I think I reflected a little bit on the last five, in that I feel like have made actually a really good game, and have, you know, made a lot of progress as a coder and a designer. Would like the game to be further along, but also like it to be good. So, you know, you'll have that. As far as the next five, I expect that to keep happening. I expect moving forward that I will keep getting better, and keep, you know, expanding things slowly and keep realizing that stuff that I did in the past isn't up to snuff anymore, and fixing that. And hopefully, you know, get the main quest line done at some point, but frankly, I would rather have a good but nominally, you know, incomplete game, than a less good, more linear done game. To the extent that done even means anything when you're talking about a game like this, right? I mean, is World of Warcraft done? I mean, yeah, when they shut the servers down. Is, you know, Twilight Heroes done? I mean, kinda. I'm adding new content to that on, you know, bi-weekly basis, if not more often. So, yeah, I'm, the other thing, actually, that I think is really interesting looking forward is how much, Puyo's art has improved over the course of the last, 5 years. And we were actually just talking earlier today, actually, about something that I have flagged that I should probably talk about at length. But we were talking about today during this larger conversation about how it would be nice to set aside, you know, a couple of days to call through the old art and actually pick out the stuff that isn't up to snuff anymore, like I do, because she's as much of a perfectionist as I am. She just doesn't look at the old stuff as much as I do, but going through that, cataloging what needs to be replaced, stuff like we did with the swords, and, you know, single shot, if you remember the old single shot art. I say if not because it was bad art, but there was, it's one of the first pieces of art in the game, and it I feel like what happened is it got expanded to 50 pixels by 50 pixels, rather than, what, you know, she obviously does now, and anyone in a rational world would do. If you're going to just, like, you know, have multiple sizes, you start out with a big one and shrink it down, or do them separately. I expect that to also get better. The other thing that we were talking about, sort of related to the fact that we've had a game for 5 years, is that we have had a company for less than 5 years. I forget exactly when Metroplex Games LLC got incorporated. We do not actually have, like, a corporate website at all. We just have, you know, Metroplex, the Twilight Heroes, and, like, the dev blog and so forth. And I'd like to, Puya and I have been putting our heads together and working on a logo. And I think what'll probably happen is that, the dev blog will actually get a redesign, and that will become the sort of redesigned dev blog will be the, like, the Metroplexity portion of the Metroplexity Games site. And look way prettier, because it's kind of like the default WordPress install right now. And I can do way better than that. I can now do way better than that. I was not capable of doing much better than that when I started. And then pulling in some Twilight Hero stuff so that there's a place for them to get their podcasts and possibly start doing the same sort of dev blog thing with, like, you know, calling people out when they report bugs. I mean, there's some, Patty Jonas, if you're listening, I probably butchered your name again, I'm sorry, reported a huge bug in Twilight Heroes that I would just love to give, you know, giant props out to, but, like, there's not really a forum for that, not in the, you know, in that sense of forum, to do that in Twilight Heroes, so I'd like to do that. And I also have a third, much smaller project that I'm sort of, is an accidental side effect of me GMing Pathfinder, basically, that I will talk about briefly, because it's something that I've been working on in my off time, in the sense that I do a lot of prep for my Pathfinder game, and running Pathfinder is kind of, well, running Pathfinder by the rules is kind of a pain, in that the monsters in 3rd edition D&D and Pathfinder work like very much like characters, like PCs, which is fine for, like, a world-building sort of sense, add some verisimilitude, all these things, but it's really a pain in the ass at the table, because you have these huge stat blocks and all of these abilities that you just sort of have to know what they do, because there are so many of them to list out properly. You know, you'll have, like, a list of spell-like abilities, and it'll be like, or spells, in the case of spell-casting monsters, and it'll be like, you know, like, 15 spells. I'm like, yeah, I've been playing this stuff for, like, literally half as long as I've been alive, so I know what most of these spells do, but if somebody's like, you know, what's the max range on lightning bolt? No. I think it used to be 60 feet in 2nd edition, and, like, reflected off walls and shit, but it doesn't do that anymore. I think the range is also substantially longer. I think it's, like, 30 feet plus 5 feet for every 2 levels of the caster, so you go back in and do the math, and blah. On the other side of this, we have 4th edition, which I talked about a little bit before in the podcast, but is a perfectly respectable game. It's just not, it's not really what my players want, but as a GM, it has actually a lot of really interesting benefits. Their monsters are also substantially more complicated than they need to be, but are presented in a fashion that is a lot more straightforward. It's like, okay, so you've got, like, you know, all of your sort of passive stats, like their hit points, their armor class, and all of these things. And then you've got their, you know, D&D equivalent of their techniques, right? And unlike, say, in Metroplexity, in D&D, like, you don't really need, like, 5 techniques, 3 techniques even, a lot of the time, unless, like, it's a crazy boss monster or whatever. you really for a lot of monsters, you just need a take a swing at the PC, you know, plus 12, 1d12 damage or whatever. And it's especially in high level play in Pathfinder, I personally need to go in and like take the monsters, compress them down into stat blocks that are actually useful in play, and like, you know, write out you know, if they have the cleave feat, you know, how their cleave works, if they have vital strike, how their vital strike works, you know, if they have like poison and all of these, you know, just like all of the actual attacks that they have that are sort of spread all the way throughout the stat block, condense them into a useful form. And at the same time, make it simple enough so you have a party of, in my case, 4 PCs, each player running a single PC that they have been running, in this case, for 13 levels. Well, I guess Puya's been running her character for 2 levels, and Jessica's been running hers for, like, 8 levels or something like that. And Liz and Durgan have been running them for, just not his actual name, but if you know him in-game, you'd know him as Durgan. Has been running his for, you know, 13 levels. So having a monster that is as complicated as one of those characters is pretty questionable. Having, like, 5 monsters, any number of which might be as complicated as one of those characters, is insane. Like, that's just not happening. And it doesn't really add anything to the gameplay in most cases, and it's combat can be run a lot easier, a lot faster, and you can add in a lot of other interesting stuff once you've sort of pared things down. It's like, okay, like, we've got, you know, these crazy demon dogs with stingers and, like, howls that terrify people, which in-game ends up being, like, we figured it out. It ended up being something like 5 separate dice rolls per round for each of those hounds. And there's a pack of them, right? If you condense that down, that's not actually even counting the howl. If you condense that down to being, you know, a couple of attacks, either, you know, 2 attacks that it can use every round, or really just, like, 2 attacks that it can choose between, make each of them more powerful, then you can take that extra complexity and put it into, like, interesting terrain or, you know, having other interactions going on during the battle. Anyway, so I'm doing this. Like, I do this before every session. It's really starting to be kind of a pain. So I've started developing some web tools for myself to do this. But in the process of setting up these web tools, I looked for like probably a good like 6 months, including at this Gen Con, trying to find like anything that remotely approaches what I want. It just is not out there. I mean, like, Dungeon World has simple monsters, but they're also not, I mean, the tricky part here is that they need to be simple and compatible with Pathfinder PCs, right? Like, they need to be, you can't have, like, a monster that doesn't interact with the Pathfinder rules, right? I've been working on some web tools for that for myself, just to make that less painful. And making some progress on that, but I will probably also be sharing those as they get, you know, refined enough to, you know, not require knowing exactly what all of the numbers mean, sort of thing. Once it's, you know, all CSS and pretty and so forth. So that will probably also be going up on the Metroplex D game side, because I can. And it'll also be a nice place for me to just, you know, talk about design stuff. So yeah, that's a pretty major project going forward. Not something that's sort of, you know, very back burner, in that I want, I mean, having, you know, this site being like, oh, I'm so great. We're so great, really. isn't very useful if we're not, you know, being great, like if we're not getting out the content. So it's more of a, you know, nights and weekends thing. But I would like to get that out there and get Skirmish, my Pathfinder project, out there. Okay, so, anyway. Back to the questions. So it seems that techniques can be applied to certain characteristics, for example, gaze techniques. Is this something that is hard-coded specifically for the pocket mirror, or should we be on the watch for more categorization of techniques? Anything similar we missed in the past? I have been tagging... That's how it's what it's called internally, is their attack tags. Techniques for... quite a while. That... immediately, sure. But there are a lot of things that are based on that same infrastructure. And some of it's stuff that... some of it's stuff that looks pretty innocuous, like the Ripazé technique for... not the Ripazé technique. The Ripazé... I should clarify that I have no idea how the word's actually pronounced. Riposte? I've got nothing. I blame the French. The swordplay technique, when it follows parry, is coded in that way, in that it looks at the previous attack and it looks at its tags and it's like, oh, this was a parry. Even though, because there are many, many forms of parry that you can get, obviously. So it's just like, if it's any of those, go for it. And it lets me tag it on the technique rather than manually keeping track of, you know, oh, there are, you know, 8 forms of parry, make sure that it catches all of these, stuff like that. And that becomes important because some of them, like, aren't... I'm not sure if it works exactly this way with the gaze, but, like, if you're talking about something like an etheric technique, there's a huge difference between, like, the quote, base form, when you're not, you know, tripping balls, to the actual, like, successful eclipse-fueled attack. And it's important to be able to catch cases like that, and things like there are, you know, slightly different effects with swordplay and different types of parries and so forth. So it's actually like every form of every attack can have tags associated with it, which makes this sound really intuitive. but it makes it way easier on my end. So when I add a new you know, gaze thing, I can just say like, you know, gaze, and it's good. So that's cool. I really like that. Rather than having to, you know, dick around in either the code or all of the techniques that reference gaze things. How many flags does an average opponent hand? Say, the painted woman, for example. Is there any subtle or obvious things that we should be cataloging? Conceptually, they have every bit as many, like, you know, combat-relevant stats as a player. They have, like, numerically all of them. But the, all of the numeric stats. But also, a lot of just, like, I mean, flags, as you say. Let's see. So, like, the painted woman has 3. Right now. It's not uncommon that I'll end up adding more. I wish there was an easy way to ask it. What's the most of any of these? I've got, like, one that's got 5 here, one that's got, Jesus, 1, 2, 3, 4, I guess 6. And that's, oops, accidentally edited that, shouldn't do that. Got some that have 0s. Not many, frankly. It is very uncommon for something not... So, that's obviously, like, so it has all of its stats, and, like, you know, its gender, its image, its name, its, you know, hover over text. So these are just, like, the extra things on top of those that, like, you know, whether it has a gas mask or whatnot. These are all handled separately like that. So, yeah. And, it is not uncommon for them to have, like, I would say, like, 4 is probably average, something like that. But there are quite a few. Some of them are not immediately obvious. They may not even have anything that triggers off of them, right? Or it might be something very opaque, like, there may be, this is completely an example, these are not actual things, but it could be, like, there's a technique that's, like, bite someone, and then there might be a version of it that looks at their tags and it's like, oh, it has the big scary teeth tag, I should have the, you know, bite someone with big scary teeth version of this technique, stuff like that. If you haven't talked about it yet, how's Novos progressing? Very well. The next phase in Novos is, percentage-wise, almost done. Obviously, I've spent a ton of time on it already, so the almost done there is within that structure. It's coming along nicely. It replaces half-ish of the existing net content, grounding it really nicely, I think, in the fiction of the world and in the areas. So that's really cool. I'm really looking forward to it. I hope that people enjoy it. I would, in theory, I could have it out this month, but I'd be pretty surprised. By this month, I mean by the end of August. So hopefully September, I would guess. Other things September, we're getting a new kitchen. Our house, which I'm sitting in right now, and therefore I assume that all of you can see, is about 101 years old, I think they said. The building with the records for the actual, you know, building dates and structure and the original blueprints and everything that the city had burned down back in, like, the 20s. But this neighborhood was built about 120 years ago. This house was renovated, like, once in, like, the 70s. I guess that's not entirely fair. They did install internal plumbing. I remember something like, I'm not going to remember this right, but there was, we found some newspapers wrapped around the pipes at one point, and it was like, Harding leaving office and, like, pardoning some people, right? So, might not have been Harding, I don't remember exactly which president it was. I just remember being like, Jesus Christ, being like, when was he president? And having to look it up, because it was as someone fairly inconsequential in the grand scheme of things, you know, as far as presidents go. And, like, they installed, like, HVAC at one point, but all done very, as cheaply as possible. So we have just, like, ducts running on the walls and stuff like this, which is kind of shitty. On the bright side, that means their house was incredibly cheap for the neighborhood, which is a very expensive neighborhood. The kitchen sucks on, like, the tiles are peeling up and all of this happy stuff. So we are actually getting, like, a new fancy schmancy remodeled kitchen. Which, yeah, is gonna be pretty cool. As I may have said before, I've started baking a lot. So I have a little baking nook, we're gonna have, like, a nice, I guess our stove right now is fine, and our dishwasher is fine, and all these things, but the kitchen itself is sort of falling apart, and there's not actually very much workspace. It's just, like, sort of poorly laid out. It's just, like, we have our floor plan is basically, it looks like the sort of thing that I would have drawn for a dungeon in, like, fifth grade. In that, it's just sort of like, each floor of the house is, like, three squares. Like, three, like, 14 by 14 foot squares. So I guess they would have been 10 foot by 10 foot if I was drawing it. But if we were drawing it on, like, 5 by 5 squares, like Pathfinder or 4th edition, it would, you know, these three by three, you know, squares and, like, a set of stairs, and then three more 3 by 3 squares built on top of them. So all of our rooms are exactly the same size. And the kitchen is just, like, has, like, a wall of cabinets and, like, a sink, a single basin sink, which sucks, but whatever, and, like, the stove. That's sort of it. And, like, we've had to pull in, like, tables and stuff to work on. Anyway, our current kitchen sucks. We're getting a new kitchen. But we're starting that September 2nd, I believe. So hopefully that will not disrupt things too much, as there will be construction sort of in the house while I'm trying to work on stuff. Probably not as bad as when we were having the roof replaced, which drove me, like, completely mad, because my office was right under where they were working on the roof. So assuming, like, that there isn't any madness involved with that, or, like, you know, the usual life stuff, I would not be surprised to see the Nova stuff go out in September. If it doesn't come out in September, it's probably because I'm busy making it awesome. But I would really like to have it out before Halloween. Because if it doesn't come out before Halloween, it'll, you know, get pushed back way into, like, towards the end of the year. And I'd rather not do that. Because I'd like to get Novo's stuff out. There's a unearthly item that's related to the Novo stuff that it's pretty huge. It's one of those things that's like, depending on when I'm done designing this, like, this is at least a 2 unearthly coin. We'll see how that goes. And then, at this point, probably Halloween, which will be a nice change of pace, working on not Nova stuff for a while. And then coming back around and doing sort of the Novos, the second wave of the main Novus content, which will be really cool. I think people will really, really dig that, even more so than what I'm working on now. It's, you know, a little depressing, but you'll have that. And that'll cover the rest of the stuff that's being sort of lost with the old net stuff going away. And if by some bizarre stroke of fate, you know, I get all of that done in, like, the everything brought over to Novos by the end of the year. I'll start working on Old Town again, because that's actually why I'm working on all of this Novos stuff. I'm not sure how much I've talked about the structure of the Old Town quest, but there's some amount of it you can probably tell already. You sort of follow through with your, you know, chosen survivor through the Old Town quest. They have, I mean, not dissimilar goals, obviously. Like, they're very much allied with each other, and they're still in communication to some degree, so they don't, like, go off and... It's not like one of them goes to Old Town and one of them goes, like, downtown or anything like that. That would be insane. It wouldn't really make a lot of sense in the story either, so not just me being, you know, realistic. I'm not even going to say lazy there, just realistic. So Dr. Amundsen's path through there, spoiler alert, involves a lot of hacking. And I was working on that, and it was just, like, just awful. Like, it was not coming together well, because of the way that I had originally built hacking. That's a large part of the reason why I'm doing Novos now and put the Old Town stuff on hold. Because, in a very real sense, the Novos stuff is Old Town stuff. Anyway, so, I'd like to get back to work on that. I'm also planning on keeping on doing, like, little weekly updates, which, I mean, I sort of skipped for Gen Con, because that's sort of an entire week by itself, but I would not be surprised to see a nice little thing next week. So forth. Some opponents have slight variations of known techniques. The Flickering Guard has a version of Release the Hounds, but summoned with a horn instead of a tome. Does that fully work as Release the Hounds? I'm not actually entirely sure that it does. Sort of mythologically, it's a version of Release the Hounds. The Painted Woman has a version of Binding Words with shadowy ribbons instead of shadowy chains. Are these completely new techniques or variations of the normal ones? Can we do either one? I feel like you might be able to do the shadowy ribbons. I'm pretty sure that you can't do the... the horn. Looks like I can't do the ribbons one either. Yep. Dev notes, NPC only, not directly accessible. a while back, I found that I was losing track of stuff in the techniques table. And put a, hidden notes field that I've been filling in as I put in stuff that's this is really, really confusing. I should just put this in here so that I know what the heck I'm looking at when it comes up again. So. Sorry, that was me finding that I'd forgotten to put something in that field properly. There are definitely techniques, as I sort of mentioned before, that are sort of because enemies can have the same sets of flags as you can in the game. There are definitely places where the techniques are just if they have this flag up, the most obvious, oldest school, so to speak, example is gas grenade. It uses exactly the same code to check whether you're wearing a gas mask or if the enemy's wearing a gas mask. So, it's just, if your opponent has, if the person you're targeting with this has a gas mask, but it works obviously the same way if, I think Al brought this up, actually. There are certain enemies that, when we started putting in, special effects for sword stuff, are obviously wielding swords, so the swords, the same thing that checks for your sword checks for their swords too. Even the ones where it's not necessarily accessible to you, you can't necessarily get all of those through, skills or items or anything. A lot of them you can. So it really just varies. If we were somehow viciously cut to pieces, what would happen? Could multiple parts survive and regenerate back into full people again? Do the samurai doctors notice that your hand continues to live after it's been severed? Will we get a chance to find out? You are not, in-world, and I'm happy enough answering this, in-world there is just one of you. So, if you cut your arm off, you have a body and a dead arm. Obviously, this can get a little tricky when you're talking about, getting totally hacked to pieces, and, which piece of you regrows. So, that is a question that actually has a lot of variables to it that I'm not going to get into, but more than just which is the large chunk. Or like, you know, the head is always the part that grows or whatever. So that said, there are, I mean, that's how the sewer people work, the mutants down there. If you cut off a chunk of them, you get more of them later. I have thought on, I mean, obviously, there's a little bit of light shed on that with the hammer interactions, but there's some other stuff in there going on that, I mean, you will hopefully get to see some more of that later. How much clips would we have to give to the Cyber Doctor before he could install giant bat wings as cyber arms? I guess almost the more interesting question would be, how much eclipse would you have to take before that actually work to let you fly? I would be much more inclined to try to install those as, like, body wear or something. But, it depends a lot on the Cyber Doctor. How about that? Are there any other things that can trigger it gained etheric that we haven't found yet? Oh, by gaining etheric, okay, like broken claw, a gaze or distant claw. I feel like, that is one of the most complicated scripts in the entire game. I guess that's not even true. It's one of the longer scripts in the entire game. Now there's a bunch of, there's a bunch of sweet ones. I'm walking in like, wow, that's really cool. That's totally sweet. I mean, a lot of them, which you have found. There's obviously a lot of different forms of Eclipse, and they're all handled sort of through the same script here. And some stuff that's just awesome. You can't hear this, but I'm totally just smiling. So I rolled down through here. Oh, yeah, so there's at least one that you haven't found. And a whole bunch of other ones that you may or may not have figured out that you can gain from Eclipse. So at least some. Sorry, I scrolled off of the question here. Oh, okay, that was actually the last one from Al. Okay, we've got some questions from Barton26. Thanks for all the new fire techniques. How long until you can equip flamethrowers and go full pyro? They're actually, at some point in the distant future, will be a lot more to do with the Blind Legion. And their mysteriousness. Why do they call themselves a Legion? And I would expect to see flamethrowers there, because they really like flamethrowers. If I'm not mistaken, I actually, from the original art request for those guys, actually have the, like, flamethrower technique picture already. And it's just not going to get used for a while, I'm sorry. Why did the smoke serpent have a special message when opposed with gas grenade? Was this the case for all untyped techniques? I actually added that message for gas grenade as appropriate. There's a couple of other creatures that should actually do that now as well. But just seemed thematically appropriate and tricksy. But I mean, obviously, it doesn't. It wouldn't have necessarily been affected anyway. Just seems sweet. Why do smelly old pants offer a benefit to us and comfy jeans do not? I'm guessing the additional crustiness provides the plus one melee defense. And the comfy jeans are just too worn down and don't have the crustiness factor. Would you ever consider implementing morality conducts, i.e. conduct for never trailing an evil cool coin action? I have actually thought about that. It would probably not be structured exactly that way. It would probably be structured as do a lot of warm coin actions and either way less or no cool coin actions. Because just avoiding those is, I think, less interesting. I think is less of a conduct. And would let you, like, I mean, like, I think the benefit of having it just be avoid them is that then you could have, like, a Switzerland conduct, right, where you don't do anything good or evil. Yeah, the Avatar features a heart glove with an eclipse decal. Will this item ever be implemented? I find that unlikely but delightful. I guess there's always the possibility of Halloween, because that seems like the sort of time that someone would bust out with that. Played any good games, video or otherwise, lately? If you haven't caught on yet, Durgan has moved here and is a really good friend of mine. I'm actually really terrible at video games that require any sort of, like, not being terrible at video games. So, I mostly actually watch other people as far as video games go. Unless it's something that, like, requires, like, zero Twitch. Like, I beat Wind Waker. But that's about it. As far as, like, Legend of Zelda goes. Other than that, I just watch Liz play Legend of Zelda. But anyway, with that said, I watched Durgan play Borderlands 2. That was a lot of fun. I actually really kind of heart their NPCs, which is not something that I will say about many video games or, like, any first-person shooters. Admittedly, that's sort of like, you know, first-person shooter that's made sweet, sweet love with Diablo. But, yeah. It's pretty sweet. Actually, well, we were at Gen Con. There were two groups of Borderlands cosplayers, and one of them was just, like, seriously, like, top-notch. But the other one, whose costumes were, like, less, I don't want to say professional, but, like, less, like, perfect, right? Their Tiny Tina was actually, like, an 11 or 12-year-old girl, which was awesome. In, like, the more professional group, was just, I mean, like, a person who could pull it off with sort of a slight, young woman, I guess, probably, like, 20s, but, like, age-appropriate Tiny Tina was just, like, hilarious. If only she could be, you know, terribly electrocuting someone or carrying around stuffed animals with explosives in them. So, Borderlands 2, pretty good. I watched part of Bioshock Infinite, which was, I mean, interesting. On the watching front, but not the game front, Liz and I have actually been going back and watching original series Star Trek in order, which is kind of depressing, because I had never previously seen, I believe it's The Cage, the pilot, the actual, there's two pilots. They did a pilot, and they came back to Roddenberry. Roddenberry did a pilot, and the studio came back to Roddenberry. It's like, yeah, we really need more face-punching, basically. And he was like, okay, whatever, and then did another pilot. So the second pilot is actually, like, Kirk, Spock, Sulu, you know, who are, like, the Titans of, you know, sci-fi. Oh my god. I'm totally blanking on his actual name. I feel like a jerk when I do this, but the guy who played Chekhov was at Gen Con, and he's just sort of like old dude with white hair, and he looked like everybody's favorite grandpa, and I just wanted to give him a hug. Obviously, it would have been weird, but totally, yeah. Aw. Anyway. I'm not even actually sure how old he is, but I really wanted to give him a hug. Anyway. So, that aside, in The Cage, the original pilot, it's a totally different cast, except for Leonard Nimoy. It might just be, overexposure to the other cast, but I like that cast way better. it might have to do a little bit with, how it was sort of like Roddenberry's original vision sort of thing. There's sort of a yeoman character in both of them who is sort of like female love interest to the captain, but competent, fairly competent. She's way more competent in the original trailer and is just sort of awesome and way more attractive, because the other one is way more 70s attractive, and the other one is sort of actually looks kind of like my wife, which is probably why I like her so much, but anyway. I so want to ship you with someone, but no one will even know what I'm talking about. Anyway. Moral of the story. If you've seen the new Star Trek movies where they have Pike in them, that's actually where Pike comes from. Pike is their captain in the original pilot. And he shows up in a later episode. Anyway, so we've been watching the original series Star Trek. And that's been awesome. Let's see. I still play Kirby Air Ride, not infrequently, which is just kind of funny. And Smash Brothers Brawl. We're sort of Durgan left a PS3, I think. that other games have been played on, but we're mostly just we play so few video games that it's just not a problem. We play Nintendo stuff. Kirby Air Ride City Trial has seriously it's such an old game, and we have played so much Kirby Air Ride. It's totally not playing it as intended, but we have a lot of fun with it. And Smash Brothers, we usually just do team play. Other than that, obviously my role playing game recentness I've talked about already. I'm really bad about getting around to playing board games. I still have a copy of Elder Sign that I got for Christmas, and I've not gotten around to playing it, which makes me feel like a jerk, but this game from Serlin, I'm blanking on the name. Puzzle Drop? Puzzle Break? Gem Break? I'm blanking on the name. Sort of a deck construction game with chips, which is kind of cool because you just put the chips in the bag and shake them and you shuffled, which, wow, I'm terrible at shuffling, so hey, works out really well. I've had that since either last Gen Con or possibly the Gen Con before that, and I've not played it yet. I want to say it was last Gen Con. But it looks really good. That's not entirely true. I played it online, so. And some questions from Arcane. Oh, wow, another podcast thread so soon. I'm still caught with my pants down. What are my questions? They must be laying around somewhere. I had a bunch. But for now, I'll do with the feel I managed to pull out between the couch cushions. Hollow Monstrosity is pretty cool. Is it the coolest, though? How would you rank it among your favorite opponents? Have we found your favorite yet? Hollow Monstrosity is definitely, top tier. I also really like the Smoke Dragon. The Hollow Monstrosity is definitely is the one that I was talking about that was my favorite that you hadn't found yet. I really just the way that it is I mean, it's sort of an absurd concept on some level, but, like, the way that it is crafted and the interactions between the various facets and strategies that you take, that's really cool. Speaking of that nightmarish glittering artistry block of content, we have anything left to find from it? Maybe another tech besides Devilish Flames? Let's see. At least one item and at least one tech that you haven't found. And I should say, like, item as in, like, item and recipe. So, yeah, you've still got some time, some stuff to find. You told me ages ago that the data scrubber conundrum can be solved strategically, that it's a strategic problem instead of a tactical one. I assume by strategic you don't mean how to get a level 6 access level, because that's no problem. What I have trouble wrapping my head around is how to be strategic about deep file scanning when all it amounts to is clicking the Browse Hidden Files button. I've done at least 64 hidden files browning, so I'll choose 3 types of file scanners and 22 code finesse to no avail, so I'm stumped. You need to scooch back further. You got the button. You moved back a level to look at the getting the access. You need to keep pulling back. The tactical level for old, yeah, as you said, is not really extant past the, you know, which buttons do you decide to click, but it's way back. So I found a new result with Mysterious Ash. If the pattern in drone memories had jumped out at you, it reminds you of drone neural nets. Now I have to ask, how much more is to this item? How many moving pieces does it have to misalign for it? Unlock amazing rewards beyond imagination. There's some all caps and italics there, but yeah. I seem to recall that there are a lot of moving parts in that item. Let's see. I mean, there's like I did not say items. What I mean is, do not think that I was about to say items there, because I was not about to say items. There are no item rewards associated with it. I think there's a lot of stuff in here. Yeah, there's like a deeply compounded set of results. There's like 20 plus or minus messages you can get off of that, and a number of different mechanical effects. I'm not sure if any of them will qualify as amazing beyond all imagination, but some of them are kind of cool. It's one of those items where I just went completely nuts. There are at least a few items now that produce special results if you multi-use a lot of them at once, popping a handful of blitz poppers for recorded blitz, unleashing an inferno from burning ectoplasm for a skill. Anything else like this remaining to be discovered? I think there are a few others people have found. Like the interaction with I forget the actual name of the item now, but it's one of the items you sell for golden tickets. If you sell enough of them once, you get a bonus. I really like that mechanic, actually, in that it encourages people for doing what you should really want to be doing anyway. I mean, not with, like, burning ectoplasms. You shouldn't want to use any burning ectoplasms anyway. I'm just a jerk. I really like burning ectoplasm, you want to be using a bunch of items rather than using them one at a time, right? Like, it's just a pain in the ass. Like, if you have to, if instead of, you know, getting a bunch of lists, poppers get her four lists, just, like, making you use, like, five of them, like, one at a time, would suck. I work really hard to make sure that using a bunch of them at once doesn't fuck you over, but at the same time, it also suggests rewarding people for doing that a lot, because it's, this is going real deep here, but there's, tangenting back to Wizards of the Coast, actually, who do Magic the Gathering, lead designer for Magic the Gathering is a guy by the name of Mark Rosewater, who is a fairly controversial figure in the Magic world, because if you're going to get angry at someone about something in Magic, it's going to be him, basically. He's sort of the face of design and development. One of the things that he has said that I think is very apt about design is that if you want to make someone, like, sort of feel good about the design, about what they're doing, you want to give them things for really doing what they already wanted to do. The example that he uses for it is there's a... So, I'm assuming some basic understanding of Magic. If not, you can just tune me out for a bit here. There's a block by the name of Zendikar that had a mechanic that... there were a bunch of different cards that had it called Landfall that whenever you played a land, you got a sweet effect. It's like, oh, okay. So, I'm playing a land because, like, I have to play a land to cast my spells, and that's, like, what I'm here to do, basically, right? But, hey, I get this sweet extra thing. And I don't actually feel like that's the strongest feature of Landfall. But the concept that, like, you shouldn't force people to do things, not that, like, you shouldn't force people down, like, weird, you know, weird corners of thought, necessarily, but, like, that you shouldn't force people to do things that are, like, shouldn't is probably a word that I shouldn't be using there, but that a lot of the coolest interactions you'll get are, like, rewarding people for just, you know, playing the game as it's supposed to be played. And, I mean, there are some other mechanics that I have in there that are sort of similarly, like anything that's, you know, sweet following a evasion technique, right? It's sort of like, oh, yeah, of course, I play my evasion first, then I play like the parry sword, parry into sword play, right? Not that parry is, like, the most useful evasive technique ever, but, it's, like, that's both works really well in the fiction, because, you know, we have a word for that, even though I can't pronounce it, even though I actually have no idea how it's supposed to be pronounced, it's just never anything that I use in conversation, because I don't fence. You should ask Eric. We have a friend who was really big into fencing, which was sort of hilarious for him because he's, like, super tall. Super tall means super long arms. I mean, you get to basically win at fencing for free because you have so much more reach than the other person. I mean, obviously, he could be beaten by a really good fencer, but he just had a really ridiculously unfair advantage. Getting back to the actual point. Making, like, that, there's a common design mistake that's basically like, let's make this is something really cool, so let's make it suck to get, as opposed to just being, like, hard to get, and so those are two very different things. Like, something can be really, really challenging to get without sucking. And it's just the difference between, like, fighting a really hard boss in a game and getting, like, the, you know, achievement for jumping 10,000 times, right? And obviously, there's a huge spectrum between there. But, and some people will really disagree on, like, where different things will fall on that scale. But, yeah. If anyone's curious, the thing that actually I think was the coolest thing about Landfall is how it sort of smooths out the variance in drawing for people. So if you... normally in Magic, you know, if you draw a bunch of lands, you're fucked, right? Like, you don't have enough spells, you have all this mana, you don't have anything to do with it. But with Landfall, assuming you have, like, a couple of Landfall things that you can get into play, you can start playing near these otherwise dead cards and get something out of them, which is really nice. And it's not even so much that it smooths out the variance, because you would much rather have an actual spell than just get the Landfall triggers, typically. But it makes it feel way less shitty when it happens. Which is important. Like, I mean, far more than any, like, oh yeah, this, like, decreased, like, the variance by, like, 5% or whatever. That's not, like, even people who are like, oh, you know, this game is, you know, too widely varying or whatever, that's not really what they're complaining about. It's just sort of like, it just sucks when you're stuck on all lands or all spells. It's just annoying as shit. Like, you don't get to play the game, you don't feel like you're interacting in any way. And even, like, a little something can actually go a long way towards that. And, I mean, that's why you won't see a lot of techniques in Metroplexity that are like, you have to follow another technique, right? Like, there's tons that are better, like, following another technique. But you won't see very many at all that are like, oh yeah, this only does anything, you know, in a long chain. Because sometimes you just don't have the hands to make a long chain. And that's already annoying enough without me, you know, rubbing salt in there. In Matchbox Anniversary, you broke tradition and made the smoke firework. This is different from the previous years where the finale represented an adjective for wet. I was looking forward to seeing such things as the dripping firework, or the waterlogged firework, or even the damp firework. What made you feel the need to move on from wetness? Sorry, I was just thinking about the word damp. I just to fit in with the, you know, the theme of smokedness that sort of pervaded with, you know, the new dragon and so forth. Before I asked you to clarify how many things outside the Charnel Hall we had to do before we discovered it's super secret, I'm hoping for clarifications. How many of those things we need to do? How many of those things we need to do things we've yet to discover? How many of those things we need to do things we How many of those things we need to do things we've yet to discover? I'm not entirely sure. I'm going to guess that the question you are asking is how many things that haven't been found outside the Charnel House you need to do, you haven't found out yet at all, to get super sweet stuff. I mean, there's basically just the one, but it's really bad. There's at least one other thing you could find stuff inside the Charnel House from if you, a discovered thing that I understand why it hasn't been found, but, like, it seems like the sort of thing that someone would have been like, I should try that. But nobody has. So, yeah, two things. One of which, stupid hard. But that doesn't itself have any subsidiaries that you haven't found. The other thing is actually found. You just haven't done it. But is from outside the terminal. So hopefully that answered some questions. To start, congratulations on reaching the 5-year mark. Thank you. Oh, sorry, this is some questions from Velma. I guess first things first is a little badgering about fishing. Well, it would not be a podcast without some fishing badgery from Velma. When it comes to fishing resulting in 2 to 5 items, is the increase in the floor a hidden modifier from the fishing skill, or is it somehow related to our rank? The gap of time between getting comfortable and getting the skill has proven to be too short to really get a lucky break. It isn't quite a floor, what you're seeing. So, it's... So yeah, there's no floor per se. That's not a very helpful answer, but I don't actually have exactly a helpful answer. But what you're seeing isn't really a floor going up. You could still get very few or zero items. It's just other factors make that become less common. One of the last sets of fishing data I collected was, well, etheric via Oceanside, and while nothing large occurred, I did have some small variances. In summary, does being etheric have a small impact on fishing, or is it just a little wobble that would have smoothed itself out? There's nothing like... I'm pretty sure I didn't do anything like making Oceanside give you more live fish or anything like that. Actual fish, I guess, is the terminology that the game uses. But I would also not be surprised, depending on where you're gathering the data, for certain items to appear or become more common or what have you, if you were etheric. Hydrast has some nifty interactions with plus service, plus deep, and plus object lures. Out of curiosity, are there any other interactions that are currently unknown? Yeah, pretty sure. there's actually just a ton going on in fishing. I think one of the reasons that you've had so much, that you've been able to, I'm not going to say have had so much trouble, because you've really cracked a lot of things open, but, why you've been able to put so much work in there and have, like, had to gather so much data is there are a lot of variables. And a lot of them are buried pretty deep. Just deep fishing, huh? yeah. But yeah, there are a lot of interactions going on there. Some of them are very, very broad, like the high test ones, like that sort of always work. Some of them are more specific to, like, individual, items that you can catch, or, like, you know, if you have this and this, you know, sometimes you'll catch, you know, sea dragon or something. There are not actually any sea dragons. Well, I guess you could call some of them sea dragons if you wanted to, but they're not... I'm not giving you a hint there. Just an example. Is there more to fish empathy, or is it actually what it says in the tin? Still an interesting little effect, though. Pretty sure it's what it says on the tin? I'm still in an impasse with the tackle box when it comes to the cheater's line. Would you care to give me a cryptic hint? I just go all in is my biggest tip for cheaters. Go all in. Don't half-ass cheating, because if you're gonna cheat, it's better to go big. Note that that is not actually good advice. If you're gonna cheat, go small. No one will be like, you cheated to get a B. Well, I mean, everyone would be like, you cheated to get a B. They'll be like, if you hand in, like, if you get like 350s in a row and then hand in a perfect test, they'll be like, if you get like 350s in a row and then like hand in like a 60 or like 65, they'll be like, improving slightly. Will there be more fishing in Old Town? That is not a terrible question. Old Town does not border on the lake. So, if there is any fishing, it would be sort of subterranean. So I'm not going to rule it out, but there won't be any lake fishing on that. I can't think of many non-fishing questions, but if I do, I'll slip them down here. When it comes to the Zalian multi-weapon, is the flamethrower matches the plus firepower, or are you wishing out a futuristic flame technology? I think it's just the firepower. I vaguely remember having art for the flamethrower, but I don't remember actually putting a technique in. So don't quote me on that. Don't quote me on there being a technique. I'm pretty sure it's just the firepower. Since the revamp, running from Thrivaldi triggers the Omega Order, tries to get them to send cleaners instead. Where exactly do cleaners fit into the pecking order? Are they of a similar tier to Thrivaldi, higher up like Janet, or do they present a larger threat of sorts? The pecking order within Midgard is very much a corporate structure. So, what you're looking at there as far as pecking order goes is, I mean, sort of a combination of two things. One is distance from the CEO. I like to think of it as generation. Sort of like Vampire the Masquerade. I assume the new Vampire has some similar mechanic, but I haven't looked into it at all. Newer Vampire, they actually re-released a bunch of the old stuff, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, more random Gen Con stuff I ran into. I was just like, oh, old Vampire books. New old Vampire books. That's way better than the new Vampire books. So, I mean, there's sort of that. There's, like, the generation, but there's also the actual pecking order, right? Like, the how it actually plays out in practice sort of thing. And that is, I think, a more interesting question. The cleaners that he's referring to, I won't get into Midgards directly, but Omnitex, Zabatsu, like, they all have sort of teams that are responsible for handling, really, like, basically paramilitary almost threats to the organization, like handling extreme security issues. Think of it as sort of like a SWAT team. Not like a SWAT team like companies talk about here. I'm not sure if you've ever been in a SWAT meeting in, like, a modern company, but it's probably fine at some companies, but it's like, what the hell? This is SWAT, really? Come on, guys. I know that you think you're awesome, but you're a bunch of black belts having a SWAT, forming a SWAT team, really? Come on. Really? It's like, you just seem like you're overcompensating at this point. Anyway. Corporate hilarity to the side. The cleaners would be people who are like, there's this crazy guy in my facility shooting everyone, and like the municipality that I'm in does not have appropriate resources to respond to something like that. Send in, you know, our people. In Midgard's case, in Metroplex, they don't, like, the municipality's people are just, I mean, Midgard security forces, right, anyway. So, it'll end up being, you know, the same. the same people responding to the call either way. So, yeah, I would, the I guess the sub-part of cleaners is that they tend to be a little scorched earth. Like, it's like Army Tech Special Forces have come up a couple of times. Those are... A part of their job would be, like, being cleaners. I mean, it's just sort of a general term that's used in-world, which is why I'm rambling about it at length, to indicate the sort of people who, like, sweep in and set everything on fire and kill everyone who has information that they shouldn't have, which is exactly, you know, what he wants then, rather than them triggering the Omega Order. Still on the subjects of the cleaners, the two of the names are Gin and Nymir. Going by the bullet crash techniques from the Spacious Cargo Pants, is Surt also a cleaner. To be clear, I believe in the text he actually refers to them separately, rather than all of them as cleaners, rather than Ymir and Gin as cleaners. But those... Three people are related. I mean, they're sort of a trifecta. Like you probably won't meet all of them at the same time unless you're really fucked. But yeah. How about this? If one of them is a cleaner, they're all cleaners. If none of them, or if one of them is not a cleaner, none of them are cleaners. If that makes any sense, they sort of are a unit. Out of curiosity, is the item gamp in the cargo pants related to function of the knuckle items we missed, or is there another items from the pockets we haven't triggered yet? There is at least one item that's missing that nobody's figured out. I don't honestly even remember how it's triggered. There isn't another pocket item, though, I don't think. Most of those are pretty straightforward. Some questions from Goldess. Are we any closer to finding out how to fish in the Lake of Mists than we were before the previous podcast? I don't think so. Is the Church upgrading the advanced harmonies from Midgar player obvious or obtuse? pretty obtuse. Is there any unique mirror gazing results from limited time opponents that have been lost forever? That's sort of a depressing thought, isn't it? It would not entirely surprise me. I always know that people feel bad if they, manage to capture something, and it's just like, oh, I got, you know, plus one XP, that's great. There's some pretty... I mean, and some of them do still, like, legitimately just give, like, you know, plus 2 XP or plus 3 XP. But some of them do, like, pretty cool stuff. That said, I don't think I am seeing any... I don't think I'm seeing anyone with a special effect that won't be coming back, if that helps. Speaking of which, have we found all we could so far find in regards to mirror gazing? Wow. There are a lot of special effects. I mean, some of them are pretty negligible. But like, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34. I'm counting 34. And some of those are multiple opponents. There might be some overlap too, though. don't take that. I didn't actually go through and be like, oh, are these the same? But yeah, there's. Some of them are fairly negligible, so like don't feel too bad if you haven't found like 34 new items or anything like that. But yeah, there's a lot going on there. Some questions from Penguin Pyro coming right up after this break. Okay, I'm back, and hopefully this is actually recording. Okay, hopefully this is still recording properly. I had some problems with Audacity, the program I use to record all of this, so we shall see. So we've got a couple questions from Penguin Pyro. What are the odds of seeing penguins in earthly or unearthly content? I would say fairly low. I hate to break the news, but I would not be totally shocked to see possibly an adorable stuffed penguin or even someone in a penguin costume for Halloween. Probably not a Linux penguin. It's the only other association I have with penguins. Although we do have penguins at our zoo. They are very cute. They're not fairy penguins, which are, I think, the cutest of all penguins, but they're pretty adorable. In 10 years, could you see yourself basically doubling the number of unearthly items you have so far, or will the madness stop or slow down somewhere along the line? What I would like to see happening is actually for some items to eventually drop out of rotation once there are enough of them in circulation. I would not be surprised to see items getting kicked out as we get, you know, on to another 5 years. Why does the player character still stay in Ish after basically injecting everything they get their hands on? I would imagine tripping 25 different kinds of clips and clips derivatives, along with many, many other psychotropic substances, would eventually take its toll on one's grip on reality. Is there some sort of mental defense in place to complement our super regeneration? I think a large part of it is actually the regeneration, in that you don't necessarily suffer a lot of the effects of the chemicals over the long term. The body attribute is in a large part representative of your body recovering from drugs much faster than a normal person. Not that, you know, a normal person can handle like 5 cups of bad coffee a day. So I guess there's a little bit of, I don't know, maybe it works out. I can't have 5 cups of bad coffee a day anymore. there was a day and age when I could drink it in, like, 3 pots of bad coffee in a night. But that day has passed. Possibly, thankfully. I will say that, all of that said, that the player characters are suspiciously stable for the stuff that they do. Some questions from Argath. Congrats on 5 years. Thanks very much, and thanks for sticking with it. Woo, Argath! go number 38! Get a jersey. You enjoy making sure that content remains unique each year, but we've hit the occasional item that is vaguely more optimal one way or another. Should we be expecting nerfs? Let's see, I'm kind of wondering what, like, I mean, I don't mind a little bit of power creep. I actually think it's generally healthy. It's just a question of how much. It's like fatty foods. Like, it's not actually, let's choose something other than fatty foods. Let's say protein. That's probably not a great example either. Let's say iron. There we go. So, you need some iron in your diet. Otherwise, you're a sad panda. Varying levels of sad pandage, depending on, you know, gender and so forth. But, sad pandage ensues. However, if you get too much iron, you end up like Baby Landon, who apparently had way too much iron in his formula for a while, and super cranky baby, because it, I'm not actually sure exactly what it does if you have too much iron, like what it does physiologically, but yes, it's apparently pretty unpleasant, or at least Baby Lantern hated it. So yeah, anyway, moral of the story, I think the power creep is sort of like that. I think that it's important for the game to evolve and change, and part of that is actually more and more powerful stuff getting put in. Unless you have some sort of mechanic that automatically rotates things for you. And I mean, Zach does that sort of. And he will do that more like when there are enough items floating around that we can permanently remove stuff. Like I was talking about in the last, you know, 5 minutes. But the... but assuming that you don't have something like the standard environment in Magic, which back in my day was called Type 2 Resin, Frozen Kids, would... but barring something like that, I think a certain amount of power creep is not only inevitable, but good. It's just when you start really, like, taking off, that it gives you problems. I would not necessarily expect any nerfs. I mean, obviously, if there's something that's totally out of line, and is becoming disruptive, I mean, yeah, that nerfs happen. But a small degree of power creep is not really a problem. 5 years! How much money would you be hoping to make on this game? Kind of an interesting question. I would accept basically any amount of money. which isn't to say, obviously, that I'm not making money now, which I am. Thankfully, everyone's generosity, particularly in the span of months that sometimes occurs between unearthly items, is enough to cover server costs and then some. What I would like if I, you know, could just, like, put a number on it, is that between, Metroplexity and Twilight Heroes and other possible projects, I would like to pull in enough that Liz doesn't feel like she has to, you know, scrimp on stuff. Because, like, left to my own devices, I would totally live in a studio apartment and eat ramen. But Liz expects me to behave like an actual human being, and have, like, you know, a house, and, like, eat remotely decent food, and by remotely decent, in this case, I mean fucking amazing, because Liz is a completely ridiculously good cook, and we have access to really good food here, like, really good ingredients. If I have not raved at length about North Market, I've been doing these podcasts entirely wrong, but North Market is amazing. Everyone who ever visits Columbus to see me, we'll have to go to North Market. Or if you're in Columbus and happen to be at North Market, I will come and talk to you and possibly eat ice cream or pho, or more likely Polish food. Because the Polish food. The Italian food, or the Indian's fine. The sushi is almost assuredly okay. The bakery's really good. Okay, alright, moving on. and that ends up being something on the order of, like, maybe $500 a month. Maybe more than that. I'm not sure if I've delved into this chunk of my personal life, we actually have been renting out. So when I had been working from home, with, like, not, you know, just doing Metroplexity games, doing, like, you know, the actually, like, quote, having a real job, big air quotes on that. Not because I entirely feel that what I'm doing now qualifies as a real job. I'm not really sure exactly what this is. But what I was doing then definitely did not. So, anyway. when I stopped doing that, I stopped really needing a dedicated office because I didn't need to, you know, talk on the phone with people anymore because cell phones. So I just we ended up actually renting that room out to Puyo, who has been crashing there. For the moment, she is actually living in the apartment that she has been subleasing because renting out our room is way cheaper. So yeah, like 500 plus Puyo's rent equals we don't have a lot in the way of problems. I would not say no to more than that, but yeah. So, yeah, sorry, I'm just sitting there thinking about numbers. The original guesstimate that we had when we were budgeting was that if things go smoothly, I could make, like, $800 a month. When everything's rolling properly. So, you know, getting little bits of content up, getting bigger bits of content out, getting donation items out on a consistent basis, having good, popular, interesting donation items. And so that would easily cover everything. I'm not entirely sure how realistic that is in retrospect. Like, I'm not sure how much money that will actually be, but like when I get like everything going, if I'll end up making that much money, but it can be quite a bit below that without it being a huge problem. But we're not gonna starve on the street or anything if I don't make that much. Doing basically fine. More like to be making more at this point because it is a sign that things are moving properly than because, like, the money is strictly speaking needed. I would rather not deplete our savings more than I absolutely have to, but this might sound weird, especially if you're not, like, completely ridiculously adorably married to someone, but really my main concern with making money is making Liz not have to stress out about finances. We could live pretty easily on just Liz's salary, but that would involve cutting corners in, cutting a lot of corners in, like, food and eating out and scrimping and saving a lot, that Liz really shouldn't have to do. Like, it's really just at that point, I'm not holding up my end of the bargain. Not that Liz wasn't completely okay with me doing this, but, like, I would just feel like a jerk, right? It's like, oh, you can't, you know, eat out or, like, even get good ingredients to make delicious food here because I can't be, you know, I can't keep up with my content release schedule. But more concerned about that and just, like, if I'm making anywhere remotely near that much money, it means that I'm hitting all of my, you know, releases, which is awesome. And I think as that goes on for long enough, as, like, hitting releases goes on for long enough, and that money flows in, and that gets, you know, theoretically reinvested. Actually, some of it has already been reinvested, and we will see the results of that once I get the combined website up, stuff like that. So, anyway, that was probably a little more detailed than you were expecting or possibly even wanting. But yeah, that's the sort of the financial situation. Second part of that question, any chance of pulling the call style yearly items, or should we carry that Zach cycles as much as he does? I would not be, like, completely opposed to putting in longer-term Zach items. I'm not sure if there's actually a need for it in the structure yet. I would, I guess, my first goal is to get them, get everything up to, you know, monthly, right? if I can't get every month in, putting in a yearly one seems sort of like overkill to me. I feel that I would be most likely to do that. Like, I would seriously sit down and consider it once, obviously, their monthly items coming out, and enough of them are getting put over into the economy that I can actually rotate them out of Zaxx. Like, I can actually retire items. Once items start getting actually retired, particularly if they're getting retired on their first cycle through, I would start strongly considering something like yearly items or something like that, just particularly for like longer. Like if there's some really cool like block of content associated with an unearthly item that I would like to have be widely available, I would strongly consider putting that on more of a yearly basis, assuming that, you know, we're talking about what we were just talking about, right? That we are just getting, that they're actually cycling through. Which, I mean, not cycling through, but actually getting removed from the cycle. I don't foresee that happening in the near future. Like, the point where I would do that, Zaxx would probably be restructured pretty intensely. So right now, you have, like, you know, the last, well, I guess, yeah, just the last five is probably fine. They might even honestly be okay, once they're, he's selling enough of them that we could just pull them after their first run through. Because I don't really ever intend to start doing, like, items in for, like, a month or anything, right? With the 5 months there, that seems fine. I'd actually be a lot more likely to do yearly items if our normal donation items were set up like Kingdom of Loathing or Twilight Heroes. But I wouldn't expect anything I would not be surprised if there was like another like actual like permanent offering at some point, like the camera. But I would be surprised to see longer term ones before things were consistently coming out every month. That would be weird. And honestly, probably before they started, you know, falling out of rotation. Do some of our prank ideas ever serve as the basic for content? Being listed to Eurasian War Dolphin Arm Grafts and Adventures of Awesome Power. There are some things that people have joked about that I have ended up putting in varying capacities. I was very tempted to put in something with the hat that someone was joking about. Or hallucinating that. I mean, one of the two. There's actually something unfound that was joked about first, and I put it in. But there are probably a couple of other things like that, too. We have no idea what we're doing when we're hunting for some of the earliest contents, and the early rare sightings of it imply the triggers may be limited. Is the flight to get the spider's nest only available one time? Can anyone at any time during the run still trigger the spider's nest? I feel like I feel like, yeah, it's triggered, certainly. Just kind of funny, I don't even think of that as particularly old content. It's like, oh, you're probably asking about something in, like, Southside Park or something like that. Oh, yeah, you might, you might be able to... Sorry, that was someone's phone ringtone. It was terrible. I feel like you might be able to lock yourself out of that. Seems fine. No, you should be able to trigger that just fine. Yeah, I'm not actually seeing anything particularly weird about that at all. Which is a little strange. Have we missed anything in the antique mirror? I think you said you found most things. If yes, can you at least point at the rough season we're missing things in? Actually, nothing that you're missing is in one season, I don't think. At least none of the stuff that I was like, wow, this is going to take a while for people to find and have been sort of watching. It's possible that there's something that I just, you know, wasn't expecting it to be hidden so well that you haven't found. But, yeah, there's a couple of trans-seasonal bits that haven't been found. Halloween is coming! Should we expect anything new added, seeing as how Metroplex Day got some new updates? That's sort of the thing with Halloween, is I'd usually just go balls out and add way too much content, and I'm like, oh my god, why did I do that? And then I'm like, oh yeah, because it's awesome. How many billions of creds would we need to sink to unlock special Halloween events, or maybe just change an animatronic raptor for the gang? I'm just picturing you running a gang birthday party with like hats and balloons and animatronic raptor. I don't know why that's so funny, but it's pretty funny. I wasn't even picturing like gangers, which makes that actually way funnier. Cuban scars, crazy custom weapons, gang jackets, little hats, balloons. maybe that's not as funny as I think it is, but I think it's pretty funny. I have not planned out the entirety of the Halloween content yet. I would expect at least some of it to involve quite a bit of building, which may or not involve a lot of credits. Aside from Halloween, we're still missing stuff in the art gallery. Does the gallery feed off any other art skills, perhaps even some undiscovered ones? There are at least one undiscovered skill in the art gallery. Might be two. And that... yeah. That's a thing. there's also some... The second floor is just not there. So that's not, like, something that you're missing. It just hasn't been renovated yet after, you know, issues, after euphemisms, there's at least one more skill there. On the topic of holidays, does the end loss of Christmas season depend on you, or is it affected by snowman values we throw around? Let's see. Thus far, I think... Well, I mean, there's a couple of different things you can consider to be the end boss. There's sort of like the cleanup boss, and that's just me giving you a present, basically. I mean, that's like, congratulations, have a snow monstrosity! Merry Christmas! because that's exactly what I would give someone. Some of the other, like, boss-esque things are determined by the values. Also, how long until we use our cars to go raid the nearby tree farms and battle farmer droids? Oh, to get Christmas trees from them? I do not believe that there are... Well, I mean, it wouldn't surprise me, I guess, if people... with apartments downtown, still got actual trees. Those two good fake trees. And actually, as much as we actually always had, like, real Christmas trees growing up, not a huge fan of real Christmas trees. I didn't mind, the sap or the smell. I didn't like the needles very much. It just seemed sort of like overkill. And a number of years, we actually... took down trees from, like, the yard, which always felt a little weird to me. I mean, like, not that we lived in northern Wisconsin, so not as though, like, we had a shortage of pine trees, right? But, you know, it was just sort of like, well, it's like, oh, but I know that tree. It's like, why can't we go get, like, some nameless, faceless tree from, like, down the street? The answer being, of course, that the one in our yard is free, except for the gasoline required to power the chainsaw. I would be surprised if you got out far enough to run into any tree farms, though, for a variety of reasons. Finally, how do most executives handle Novos? It's an incredibly powerful, elegant system, but it's also incredibly vicious and self-destructive, meaning anyone who needs to use it for a length of time would probably have a large set of pre-generated dice, according to their job. Any chance we're going to have to steal, hack, find, in quotes, some of those on later systems? It would not surprise me. Mechanically, if you have the right interface program, you're not really hacking like Novos does, right? You're just doing whatever it is the interface does, like the test system in the lab near the slags. You can hack it, obviously, but you don't need to hack it to pass the test. You can just... I mean, it's just a computer, right? Like, you can just use it. But the... it would not surprise me if you had to gank somebody's programs at some point to interface properly with the system that they're used to running on. Depending on what sort of access you have, that may or may not even require really proper hacking, though. It might just be you have this program running. Click on the do stuff option in the choice adventure and you're good. May or may not be as exciting as you're thinking, because if you have the right interface and the right access, it's trivial to do what you want, unless, you know, the interface sucks. I guess interface, knowledge of how to use the interface, and access. But all three of those things can separately or together be, you know, challenges. Like, you might, for example, have to steal some guy's program, have that program running on your computer, if your comet isn't powerful enough to run most of these things, and have acquired knowledge of how to use it somehow, whether that's by like reading books or reading files on, you know, the dude's website, or just trying it a bunch or what have you, and getting the appropriate access. So you might still have to hack into the system and have it running if you can't usurp his access somehow. So yeah, I mean, that can still be pretty complicated, but the program itself might have to be running. It might even be just represented as like data, because a lot of those will be pretty lightweight. But yeah, it would not surprise me at all for you to see something like that. Or will the old rules of security through obscurity lead to hidden systems that run oldest for the simple reason of being very stable if slow system? I would be surprised to see anything in Oldos once Novos is fully rolled out. Both because for the simple reason that I wouldn't want to have to maintain that code anymore, and I'm sure that the system admins in Metroplex agree with me. I don't want to maintain that code either. But also for a variety of other reasons. They're sold to be like, everything will get replaced with Nova stuff, and then there'll sort of, the older stuff will get completely shut down. And that, you'll get to see that play out. As real time as you see anything. Couple questions from Acid Cat. Just wanted to say, as a latecomer to Novos, seems much more balanced than Oldos, and that's a heavy Oldos review. Good work. Thank you. I'm glad that that's worked out for you. Just as a slight variation of what Arkham said above, do you add content based on our wildly inaccurate spading ideas or questions on the podcast questions thread, especially as you have incredibly obscure content, which I'm amazed even the spaders managed to stumble upon. It seems like it would be easy to slip in. There are definitely things that I've ended up adding for stuff like that. Sometimes it's things that, Al sent me a bug report not long ago that was like, hey, these enemies seem like they should be using the sword versions of this technique, but they're not. Is that a bug? I'm not really sure. And I mean, it was a bug in that I should have thought of it and done it, but I hadn't. And I went through and added swords to them from the code side, basically. just put in the sword flag on them, as we were talking about earlier, actually. And, I mean, there are some other ones that people have pointed out. There's actually some of the Novo stuff when people were first spading it, that there were some ideas that were so good that they've actually been carried over into some of the new stuff. Most of the time, people will have really good ideas, and it'll show up in newer content, or it'll inspire something in newer content. Usually when I add something like that, at least the person who's asking about it knows. There might be other spades that end up with problems, I guess. I usually try to thank them in the dev blog, too, just, you know, to give some, I mean, both because I added some content at their suggestion, and that's awesome, means, at least from my view, that it's a really good suggestion. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of content that's been suggested by one person or another. Let's see. I'm sure there are other really good examples, but no, there's been quite a bit. I actually have a Word document, and I should move this entirely over to a better system for handling it. Things like Let's see. Unfortunately, I remove them and I actually do them. So I'm looking through to see if there's any recent ones. Oh, there's a really good suggestion from ages ago about the OmniWatch that I haven't gotten around to implementing yet. Things like that. Even more than just the suggestions, a lot of it is like, oh, we're really interested in, you know, X. More X will show up. I mean, it's if, you know, I have if I get a lot of questions about the Blind Legion, there's sort of a entire quest chain that's sort of planned for them. Obviously they're trying to recruit people and you can't join them right now. Like, that's a pretty obvious content vector, right? If people are like, yeah, Blind Legion, woo! I'm a lot more likely to be like, okay, let's queue that up. Let's do that next. I've got, I try to do, a little bit of content as often as I can. Just shooting for once a week, but, more or less is fine. Maybe one of those could be, a contact with the Blind Legion. Like, him explaining what's going on a little bit and giving out some quests. Or little quests, like questlets. baby quests. Cheep, cheep, cheep. In a broader sense, if someone's going to be really interested in, going to ask me a bunch of questions about, Xalien Team Omega, and, what's up with Xalien Team Omega, and, what's their universe like, and, you mentioned all these franchises, and, it doesn't really go into a lot of detail in the game, could you tell me more about that? Someone's interested in this, I should consider doing it, and, if I think about something enough and have to, articulate, here are the franchises and the similarities between the franchises and, how that's structured and, here's, the CCG that's based on that, how that interacts with, the franchises and the roles that they've created, sort of the iconic roles that show that, you're watching. One of the shows within one of the franchises within this, I guess, broader franchise, meta franchise. Shows within the franchise is probably better. So, the different shows. Then, as I articulate that more, it means that I'm more likely to hit on something that I'm totally stoked about putting in, whether you like it or not. Or, it'll just, I'll be working on, I'm working on the Novos stuff right now. If I'm working on some Novos content and, you're hacking a site that belongs to someone who thinks that ZTO is the best thing ever, then I have more information to bring to bear on that, and you get to see, stuff that's come up on the podcast in the game, which I think is cool, and I get to have, this completely, obscure, writhing mass of references that, above and beyond just, fulfilling my obvious need for, absurdly complicated interlocking content. That's what makes Worlds real, I feel. It's not, the amount of content. You could have, 100 hours of gameplay. You could have 100 hours of good gameplay, and not have it be a world. And that's not to not to diss, you know, a game that has 100 hours of good gameplay, obviously. I mean, that's pretty fucking sweet. But it becomes a world when the interrelations between things become dense enough that it sort of curls in on itself, right? And so when, you know, you're looking at, you know, okay, I'm still on ZTO here because, I mean, that's the last thing I was talking about, I guess. So if you're, you know, hacking the site that I was using as an example before, and you're looking at the ZTO stuff, it mentions that it's produced by Zaibatsu, because it's produced by Zaibatsu. Okay, so, you know, I mean, if you just think of it as like almost like a wiki, you know, what else? Okay, so it links to Zaibatsu. What else links to Zaibatsu? And you've got, like, you know, you've got Matsuo, you've got My Little Adoru, you've got all of these huge franchises under Zaibatsu, and oh, and they also link over to Omnitech, and all this stuff that links over to Omnitech. And okay, if you look at that, just that isn't enough, right? You've got all of these connections, but you don't have, I'm going to go kind of deep here right now, but you don't have any loops or clicks, in like a group of people type click, the C-L-I-Q-U-E type click, clicks in sort of the mathematical sense, the node sense, are groups of fully interconnected nodes, right? I say right, like everyone should know what I'm talking about. But yeah, so if you have like, okay, so Zaibatsu produces ZTO and Matsuo, right? If there was, you know, a line of, like, if I had included a reference in the Zalian multi-tool that was, like, the replica weapons, you know, branch of Zaibatsu that makes this, also makes the Matsuo replica sword. I don't know if I actually did this or not. But it reasonably would be the same branch. I don't recall exactly who actually makes the multi-tool, but that's not here or there. I'm pretty sure it's just a branch within Zaibatsu. They're not the types who would usually farm that out. Or if they did, they would kill everyone, and that would, you know, that would explain why you got it. I'm pretty sure it's just Zaibatsu. Anyway. But, so it's, so if you've got, like, Zaibatsu, ZTO, Matsuo, and back to Zaibatsu, that's a click. And then, if you add another thing that's connected to all three, that makes it much stronger. And when you start doing that, when you start having this whole structure of interrelated groups, and not just like one-to-one lines, we're talking like a densely interrelated network of concepts, that's when it really starts to become a world. So, like, still on the corporate level, because corporations kind of, you know, run the place. But if we go over to, you know, Midgard and Omnitech, you know, both big corporations, Omnitech's bigger than Midgard. Midgard uses a lot of Omnitech's products in their construction, like polysteel in particular. And so you've got these two companies that are connected. They're both connected to polysteel. Great. They're both also connected to a lot of different types of drones. Midgard's being obviously ones that you run into more, but Omnitech also has its own line of basically fucking everything. They're just usually not as good as the specialists. But you can go your entire life without buying a non-Omnitech product. But they have, you know, they have their mining drones, and Zaibatsu has its mining drones. And those drones will, when they come up in the world, will probably be connected to each other, right? Like, just in a, this is, you know, an Omnitech mining drone. It's not really as good as the Midgard ones, but it's a lot cheaper. There's that line there. And so the Omnitech mining drone is connected to Midgard mining drone is connected to Midgard itself, and is probably made out of polysteel, so it's connected back to polysteel too. So you get this expanding network. Oh, Midgard mining drone, probably also made out of polysteel. Okay, is already connected to the Omnitech drone. Might also reference Omnitech itself, may not. So it may not be like a technical click anymore, but it's still really densely connected. And of course, that mining drone is, you know, connected to, you know, depending on which drone you're talking about. If you're talking about like the burrowing drones they were using to rescue people after the dorms collapsed, it's connected to its etheric version, and it's connected to Eclipse, and that's connected back to Midgard. And so there's these overlapping networks, and once that gets dense enough, it really becomes its own thing. And that's, and so, anyway, a lot of what, so as people ask questions and as people do spading, a lot of the things that they're looking for are actually based on those connections, that might be there that I just didn't explain very well, or are there, like, in-world, but aren't in-game, that need to be sort of, here's how this actually works, right? Like, here's who produces this item. Here's why these two groups hate each other. Here's how, you know, Janet Barsikov feels about Ymir, and how Ymir is related to Gin and Surt, and why there are bullets with their names in your pants. Like, what the shit? What is going on there? And admittedly, like, those, there's some parts in there that I specifically haven't elucidated yet. But there obviously are connections there, right? And I think, so, beyond even just having the connections, having this dense mass in some areas lets you look at others and be like, okay, there's obviously something here. And sometimes that's a clue for spading. Sometimes that's just a story thing, like the Ymir and Gin. The fact that you can, that I'm getting, you know, getting questions like, oh, so Surt is clearly in there too. Like, Surt is clearly with the American. Like, that's, they're obviously, like, a thing, right? A unit. Because they've been presented this way elsewhere in the game, and it is, they're connected through, Thrivaldi. He obviously has some idea what he's talking about. That the ability to do that, the ability to actually reason and infer on the basis of the setting, is what makes it a world. Like, I can have, like, all of these pretty connections all that I want, but if I can leave one out and have people be like, oh, there's something missing there. There's something missing. I should either, you know, try to figure it out, ask about it, see if I can spade something cool. That right there, that's it. Like, that's sort of, I feel, is sort of the spark there, the difference that separates almost, like, I don't want to say like a setting, like a setting isn't, you know, is what we're talking about, but that's what separates a world from, like, just a setting. Like, the feeling that you could, you know, that you can reason and infer on these things, that you could, you know, not even so much that you could, like, you know, walk out the door and not get lost, but, like, which would be pretty cool, but there's a lot of things can do that for you. I mean, a decent 3D model will I mean, I probably wouldn't get too super lost in Rivendell, but, well, I mean, I shouldn't say that Rivendell isn't, you know, that Middle-earth isn't a world, because, Jesus Christ, Tolkien. J.C.R. Tolkien. But, and I think that that's actually another sort of interesting example of what I'm talking about with those sort of, that sort of network. Like the, not even so much the Lord of the Rings, but like the Silmarillion, where there's a this real deep networked connection that that lets you, I think, make some pretty reasonable assumptions based on how things are presented. But yeah. Anyway. So yeah, a lot of. I mean, there's, yeah, some of it's just like, oh, that's a really good suggestion, like, I had literally forgotten to do that, and sometimes it's a show of interest, let's go in that direction, and sometimes it's, yeah, you're looking in the right place, you're gonna find out about it quite yet, or maybe for quite a while, and admittedly, like, there are a lot of places where, if you look through the network at the right angle, things will line up, right? Like, oh, so this is also referred to as this in a different place. Low, right? Like, I think it comes out and says at one point that he was referred to his code name when he was working for Midgard Special Products was Loki, right? Projects. I think I said projects, but if I said products, it's projects. Yeah, his code name was Loki. But if it hadn't said that explicitly, right? Like, you'd probably figure it out, right? Like, when they're referring to Loki in certain places, they're probably talking about Lo, right? And there are a lot of places where people have inferred things like that. And that means that I'm doing a really good job. not to do my own horn or anything, but I this is one of the things that I feel I do really well as a game designer. World designer, whatever you want to call it. But the other, the flip side of that is that there's actually still a lot of these connections left to be found, which is awesome. I mean, there's this whole, not just mechanics, like mechanical spading, but someone could go through, never log into the game, look through, like, all the text that's been posted on the wiki, and figure out some pretty crazy shit that, like, has not been put together, right, about the game. And that's also awesome. I don't think that, you know, the wiki is necessarily the, you know, place to, you know, the format that the game is best enjoyed in, necessarily. But I think that, yeah, that's another thing that speaks to, you know, worldness, right? That I could do, like, you know, a comic book or something set in the world, and it would still very much feel like the world. Like, it wouldn't have to be like, oh, we have to make sure that, you know, our product identity is clearly represented here. Although, I mean, that is what's going on, right? Like, I mean, that's sort of what, I mean, this world that we're building is sort of a, I mean, could be considered product identity, whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I don't have to, like, plaster, like, Metroplexity, like, it's from the game Metroplexity on the cover. You'd be like, oh, yeah, like, this is clearly Metroplex. Like, this is not, like, something that is just, like, you know, similar. This isn't, like, a Shadowrun book, right? Which I think is also a pretty good world. meant I really enjoyed as a setting, regardless of whether it's, you know, worldy or not. But at the same time, you'll have other ones that you could sort of throw, you know. I feel that I think this is actually kind of an interesting discussion, so I'm going to keep talking. And by discussion, I guess I mean sort of rambling monologue. I was talking about Pathfinder before. I really like Pathfinder, so this is not a dig on Pathfinder. I really like Pathfinder's settings for a lot of reasons, so this is not a dig on their setting, Galarian. But it would be difficult to consider Galarian a world in this sense, sense that I'm talking about. There are connections, but they tend to be very tenuous. And I've been talking about like how awesome this all is. But there are always other considerations. In Galarian, each nation is effectively its own setting, its own type of adventure. If you go to Phyrexia for, like, traditional D&D dungeon crawling, tombs of ancient wizards and, like, their massive monuments that are built by enslaved giants and all this really badass stuff, that, like, if you go, you know, a couple days travel in any direction, it's more than a couple days, but if you go far enough in any direction, you sort of cross over the, like, magical border into a different region. Magical being sort of sarcastic there. Not like there's actually, like, a magical wall or anything. It's not Ravenloft. You have this wholly different set of concerns that have jack-all to do with Thassilon, the, you know, ancient wizards that I was just talking about. But that's really good for what they're trying to do with setting. I can pick up the, like, little Phyrexia guidebook, read the chunk about Phyrexia on the wiki, and be ready to go, right? Like, if I'm setting in a specific town in Phyrexia, okay, I need to learn something about that town, too. But if I'm just setting a campaign in, like, the wilds of Phyrexia, I'm done. I'm prepped. Prep completed. And if I'm setting a game north of there, in the Land of the Norm Kings, which is also badass, I can read up on the Land of the Norm Kings, and, like, there are some connections there, like, it's not completely, like, you know, these nations floating in vacuum, but they are very, very separate, like, much, much more separate than what I'm talking about with Metroplexity, because it makes prep so much easier and makes it so much easier to run the types of campaigns you want to run. Like, if you want to run your game in, like, the Land of Witches, locked in Eternal Winter, they've got that. If you want to run your game in, effectively, Egypt, I prefer to think of it as totally not Egypt. They're not trying to pretend it's not Egypt. It's very much like, here's where you put, like, your pyramids, your fucking mummies, go. You want to run God E1, or whatever the pyramid is. I think it's just called the pyramid. Return of the Pharaoh, whatever. The classic pyramid adventure. If you want to run that, it goes in Assyrian. You're good. Go. Like, go forth and conquer. So they have this different model, which is equally valid. Well, I'm not even going to say equally valid, because it's not really either of our places to judge the validity here, but does something completely different, which is also good. Like, it's provides the toolbox that you need to run any kind of campaign they could possibly want within their setting. And if that means sometimes that, you know, countries next to each other maybe should be a little more related, then that happens. No bigs. Or rather, I mean, you can't make an omelet without breaking some eggs. basically. Because Stalin. I don't know if that's actually Stalin or if people are just whiny bitches and attribute it to Stalin to be annoying, but I think that that's the least interesting, but that's what I'm trying to do with building this world, and they have obviously a different set of requirements, and so are going about building a totally different type of setting. That incredible digression aside, I'm really looking forward to, as Acid Cat says, here's to the next 5 years. I'm really looking forward to them, and I see no end in sight as far as Metroplex D goes, or Twilight Heroes, if you also are interested in Twilight Heroes and all. And I'm looking forward to showing you more of this world that I was just talking about, and getting some more gameplay in there, obviously. Fixing things as I become a better and better designer, and I become more and more annoyed with old designer self, and showing off what new designer self is able to do. And on the same note, showing what new artist Puyo is able to do, and moving forward with her, because it's incredible to see the difference between the stuff she's putting out now and the stuff she was putting out when we were getting started, which is really funny on a lot of levels. Like, it's obviously, like, I've been doing this game design stuff for, like, literally as long as I can remember, so this shouldn't surprise me that other people have a very similar experience, but, like, she, you know, has an art degree, right? It feels like, you know, she should have been, you know, already at the top of her game, and that's obviously not how that works, right? Like, that's not how any skill works. It's just sort of funny to realize that even as I am advancing in, you know, my own field, right, that I'm sort of like, wow, like, you're really advancing in your field exactly like I am through constant practice. And that's awesome. Like, I'm really happy for her, but I'm also really happy for me, because I get to do what I really love, and at the same time, learn and improve on that, which is, I think, something that gets undersold. You'll have a lot of people who are like, there's a lot of industries who have this. I mean, it's not as bad as me being like a football coach or something. There are a lot of sort of like armchair designers out there who are like, oh, I could do this so much better. Which, I mean, in some cases you could, or like, I am such a great designer. It's like, okay, you might be a great designer. You might even be a better designer than me with no practice at all. That's totally fine. I just don't see much point in arguing about it, frankly. But there is no one who is a better designer now than with you know, having not designed anything, than they would be if they had been designing something constantly for the last 5 years, right? I mean, not even just one specific thing, just anything. So, sort of, I guess, to end on a sort of weird note, if you are really interested in something, whether that's making games, whether that's playing music, writing books, you know, art, like Puyo, you know, making the world a better place, like Liz, whatever, I mean, even just, you know, making really fucking good lattes, whatever. Like, whatever you are passionate about, whatever you really want to be awesome at, or think that you are awesome at, or, I mean, are awesome at, right? Like, don't let that lie fallow. Just go for it. Like, it's hard to justify the time sometimes if, you know, it's not something that you can do, you know, as your day job, right? Time is not something that comes freely. There is a cost attached to that, but you will get so much better at those things, and you will be able to watch yourself go from, you know, not being able to play an instrument to actually being, like, professionally level competent at it. Even if you're not, you know, getting hired to do gigs or whatever, you will be so much better at it. And you will be, if it's something that you're really passionate about, like, passionate enough about it that you don't care if you're getting paid. Like, if you are about playing guitar, like I am about game design, that it's just something that you would be perfectly happy doing, even if, you know, you don't get paid, fucking do it. Like, just go out there. And eventually you might get to a point where you have done that enough, you've gotten that much better, that you're actually, you know, people will start paying you. And it's awkward as shit, because, you know, you are doing something because you love doing it, and people are giving you money, and it's kind of weird. But it also is kind of awesome, right? Like, maybe you'll get to do that. But I guess the important lesson that I was trying to get to there is just, if there's something that you really love doing, do it. Doesn't mean necessarily, you know, quit your day job and go run off and, you know, start designing games full time. Unless, you know, your day job is nice enough to run away on you instead. But just do it. Maybe that's obvious. I don't know. But it's sage advice from, you know, Nike commercials, I guess. Well, thanks very much for listening and for donating. And thank you so much for the last 5 years. And here's to the next five. And I think that I can say with certainty that the next 5 years will be better. Not in that, oh, I've done such a terrible job, I've missed all these updates and whatnot, but I mean, every day I'm designing, and every day I'm becoming a better designer, and I want to show that to you. And so, let's rock it out. Let's see where the next 5 years bring us. Thanks very much. Have a great summer.